It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Dan Patterson is here from CBS News, from The Protocol, protocol.com. Owen Thomas from Consumer Reports, my favorite magazine, been a longtime member. Nicholas De Leon, we've got lots to talk about. Meta losing more value in the, it's the biggest stock wipeout in history this week. They say it's Apple's fault, is it? We'll talk about Google breaking $200 billion in annual revenue for the first time. Silicon Valley and the Mafia. Self-driving software that runs stop signs. And North Korea hacked him, so he took down their internet. All that and more coming up next on Twit.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 861, recorded Sunday, February 6th, 2022. Magic Internet Money. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Linode. With Linode, there are no hidden fees, and you can scale up or down without penalty. Get $100 in credit by visiting linode.com/twit. And by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free at podium.com/twit or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. And by Our Crowd. Our Crowd helps accredited investors invest early in pre-IPO companies alongside professional venture capitalists. Join the fastest growing venture capital investment community at ourcrowd.com/twit. And by Nureva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation can take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex, expensive. But Nureva Audio, it's easy to install and manage, no technicians required, and you get true full room coverage. And that's easy economical. Learn more at Nureva.com. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. And I've got a good panel, as always, to join us. Nicholas De Leon is here. I'm sorry, De Leon. I always say it wrong.
De Leon, actually. De Leon. But thank you. Yeah.
So the third chimes the charm. Hi, Nicholas, senior reporter for electronics reporter for Consumer Reports. Always a pleasure to have you on. Leon.
De Leon. Yep.
You say it properly. So I should just say that.
It's a real struggle. You know, when I was a kid, De Leon, it's pronounced De Leon. I think folks can handle three syllables, to be honest with you.
So, I think we can. De Leon. We'll do it. We'll do it.
Owen
Patterson is also here. He is Dan Patterson is here. Technology reporter, CBS News. Dan, always good to see you. Welcome.
You too.
Yep. You'll see him on the streaming service of CBS News, which is bigger, brighter, and better than ever. A lot of effort being put into that right now. Also, speaking of new publications, Owen Thomas is back. He is at Protocol celebrating 2 years, and it's still free, no paywall. You're still happy with that?
Yeah, we've talked about paid products down the road, but it still seems like early days right now for that.
It's a great resource. I use it all the time.
Thank you.
We quote you all the time. In fact, we're going to quote you about Meta in just 3 seconds. There's so many places we could begin here. I could continue with the Joe Rogan saga, which gets wilder and wilder as we go. But I think we should talk about Meta. The company formerly known as Facebook, which suffered the biggest stock market loss, biggest wipeout, as Bloomberg put it, in history this week. Shares went down 26%, which is a $251 billion change in value. I want to, though, be clear, and I'd love to hear what you all think about this. This didn't come out of Mark Zuckerberg's pocket. This is not, they don't have a bill for $251 billion they have to pay. This is the stock market valuing the company. you know, it's shareholders, I guess, who will lose money. Not, and you know, to the extent that Mark's a shareholder, I guess that means his stock is worth less. And I think some of this is because analysts had, you know, were disappointed, which seems like a terrible reason to take value off the company. Owen, do you think Facebook Meta is worth less in reality or just in the stock market?
I mean, what is real, Leo? You
know. NFTs, baby. That's what's real.
I mean, what's the difference between a share of stock and an NFT? It's all like a belief.
That's a good point. Right? It's fiat currency. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a share is a theoretical claim on the future earnings of a company. So I think what people were scared about here was not the present, you know, how Facebook is doing, you know, how Meta is doing as a company right now, but the future, the fact that users of the Facebook app, you know, the blue app actually dropped.
First time ever.
Right. And also usage, you know, I think the death spiral is not just people like quitting the service or not, you know, Facebook not replacing users it's losing fast enough. It's, you know, it's usage. And I think Facebook is really scared of TikTok as they should be.
Yeah. I mean, this should have been in the stock all along because we know young people don't really use Facebook. It's their parents' social network. They use TikTok or Snap or something else. Then maybe they use Instagram, which is Facebook's, you know, holding action against the youth. Facebook actually did a really interesting thing. They took advantage of this moment to blame Apple. they said, it's Apple's fault. We lost $10 billion because of the checkbox in, you know, that you now get on iPhones where it says you want to let this company track you. I don't think they can actually demonstrably prove that that was where the loss was. In fact, the $10.2 billion loss came from the Reality Labs. It's VR efforts, which have been very, very expensive with, of course, very little revenue.
Well, those are all of those are two.
Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
Those are
no,
two
go
things.
Ahead,
yeah. There's, you know, there's the hard cost of investing in AR and VR. And then I think the other $10 billion, I mean, and, you know, $10 billion here, $10 billion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money. The other $10 billion was missed revenue.
Right.
Like revenue that they could have gotten but didn't get.
Right.
So I think that there actually are like two separate chunks. And like you add that up, that's a $20 billion delta.
Am I crazy, though, Dan, to say that Facebook would like you to blame Apple? But in fact, Facebook doesn't want you to know is they have perfectly good other means of tracking you. They don't need Apple's ID for advertisers, and turning that off is actually meaningless from their point of view. But they would like to pretend, it seems to me, that's it's killing me. It's killing me.
Well, I don't mean this in the cultural sense, but I think all of these issues are real, substantial, and intersectional. I talk to people at Facebook who genuinely think that they will stay off record. They genuinely think that the changes in iOS 14.5 and 15 did kneecap them, or at least in the very short term. But I think that the larger picture is certainly this drop in usage, which they have tried to duck into this or roll into this pivot to VR. So all of those things intersect with each other, and all of them as the end result, not just result in losing money, but a loss of influence, because that's really what money is, right? It's influence, power.
The daily active users went from 1.93 billion to 1.929 billion. Now, admittedly, what is that? That's a lot of millions. That's like a million. But when you have 1.9 billion users, I think it's almost a rounding error. Should we, Nicholas, what do you think? Is it over? Should we just throw in the towel? Should Facebook go home?
I don't know if Facebook should come. I have this conversation with my bosses and my friends all the time. Like, have we reached peak tech? You know, I do wonder what, like, Gen Z, like, are they Are they so, do they even remember a time before technology? Are they over this stuff? Do they not care? Is it not cool anymore? You know, if you're a parent and you're thinking of sending your kids to college, do you want them to pursue a career in tech? Have we reached peak tech? I don't know. I was recently in Puerto Rico for a family thing. And I would say, just seeing, hanging out with friends and family down there, Facebook, meaning the big blue app, is still, heavily used.
And
certainly
WhatsApp, right?
Oh yeah, WhatsApp. It's funny when I've probably sent like five iMessages in my life. Actually, I'm on WhatsApp all day talking to my family, so yeah. I kind of have a slightly different perspective on like the messaging wars, I guess. But yeah, I don't know if I don't know, people are just over tech. I don't know, especially the past 2 years of looking into Zoom calls and all this stuff. Are people just burnt out? I don't know, but I think it's a very interesting question. I obviously don't know the answer. But yeah, I guess we'll see, you know, I guess Zuck is trying to pivot to the metaverse, which, I don't know how that will go. I suppose I'm more inclined to be cool with that as a big gamer and as a huge nerd. It's like, that's neat to me, but like, is my adopted mom going to sit there with a AR or VR headset all? No, she's not. That's never going to happen. So I don't know. Very interesting series of events here.
I think you're right. I think the stock market anyway says we're at peak tech and it's over and we got to find something else. I should point out, though, if you bought into Facebook when it IPO'd, you're far from underwater. You've still made more than $250 a share since the IPO, as my wife keeps telling me. it's not the end of the world for Facebook. I often wonder when you see these kinds of drops. Apple lost almost $200 billion in 2020. And by the way, that would have been a good time to buy some Apple stock because not only did it recover, it kept on growing. I often wonder, you know, Monday, is the stock market going to say, okay, we had our sell-off, let's back to business as usual. So that's the real question for me. I don't care about the stock market so much, but the real question for me is this a bellwether? Is it the beginning of the end for Facebook? Is Facebook going the way of MySpace? Are they going to be able to make a pivot to augmented reality? Clearly, Zuckerberg feels like it. He actually had an all hands the day after the stock tumble. His eyes were red and watery, but he told everybody it was because of a scratched cornea, according to Bloomberg, who had unnamed persons at the event. He apparently, you know, repeated what he'd already said in the earnings call, that it was the rise of TikTok. Unprecedented level of competition is the phrase. Reels competing with Instagram. But he also said, I want you all to focus on video, that this is the future. And I guess, does he mean video as in VR?
Turned out great last time.
Yeah. I mean, their homegrown video platform was a terrible flop, right?
And not just Facebook, but for media companies as well.
Yeah, Microsoft flopped with Mixer. Facebook spent a lot of money to bring creators over. That didn't go anywhere.
Well, Facebook also, I mean, the last time they did a pivot to video, they, a couple, maybe 18, 36 months afterwards, they said, oops, we did a miscalculation, which caused companies like Mike to just vanish overnight.
Yep. I guess that's one issue with this is it could be that the tremors will be felt throughout the tech market, as you say, Nicholas, because Facebook is so kind of pivotal for news organizations, for everybody in driving traffic, that a failed Facebook might be bad in general for the tech industry. So maybe that's what we're seeing. I know, I find it hard to write them off at this point.
Well, and they're a platform, like, unlike MySpace. I mean, the comparisons to a previous era of tech are just not the same.
That's true. It's not MySpace. Yeah. That's a really, really good point. Well, anyway, there's the meta, the meta story, such as it is. It's a great number, though. $251 billion in value. That does hurt in a couple of ways. It makes it harder to attract talent because, of course, you pay them in stock options. So it hurts in that way. It might make it harder to raise money if they needed to. So it's not a neutral event from their point of view at Meta. And it's a bad headline. But I don't think it means that they're necessary. I mean, 1.9 billion daily active users. That's pretty successful.
You know, one point about attracting talent, they have had problems attracting engineering talent. And in the Valley, their reputation is pretty bad, at least when it comes to engineering talent. But on the other side, although we talk about all the losses, the $10 billion in their Meta component, they've attracted a ton of people from Microsoft, a ton. And the HoloLens people are pretty pissed off right now because they killed HoloLens 3. So they've done a very good job of attracting talent, experienced talent when it comes to AR, VR, and XR.
Yeah.
I have to think, though, that, you know, part of the problem here is like Mark Zuckerberg is saying, hey, we're not the Facebook company anymore. We're Meta. AR and VR is where it's at. So if you're working at Meta on the Facebook app, you've got to feel like you're a second class citizen, right? Like you're not taken seriously, even though you bring in all the money. And that's got to hurt morale. Like, how are they going to hire, you know, engineers to work on, you know, fixing misinformation or optimizing ads or, you know, dealing with the Apple, you know, the Apple ID issue? That's where I think they're going to feel the pinch.
Although, remember, Apple is paying $180,000 bonuses to its engineers not to go to Facebook. So it is a cutthroat competition in Silicon Valley for engineering talent. If you're good, you can write your own ticket. So all of these companies are trying to keep people, not just Facebook. And I don't think Facebook's the only company losing talent either. I think people just move around to kind of increase their value. Alexis Ohanian, I don't know if he's the expert on this. He's a VC now, co-found Reddit, said, we all knew this was going to happen. He told Bloomberg, Facebook ad product just doesn't cut the mustard anymore. The savviest marketers have started ditching Facebook for advertising. That might be the case. I don't think it has to do with Apple, to be honest with you. I think Facebook has plenty of ways of knowing who's watching what on their platform. But is it the case, do you think, that advertisers are turning their back on Facebook, that it's no longer the place to go? That would surprise me. What do you think, Nicholas?
Well, one thing I will say is that I never get better ads than I get on Instagram. My interests are pretty explicit. I'm into soccer. I said this before, soccer, video game stuff, watches. Those are pretty much my three things. And every ad on Instagram is related to one of those three things. And I've definitely purchased several items off Instagram. So I don't know how they do it. You know, I have a mixture of like, don't follow me, don't track, ad blocker. I try to put up a fight, I guess. And yet, the ads on Instagram are pretty good. So I don't know if marketers, I don't know, they seem to be having a pretty good time, at least over at Instagram.
To be nuts to abandon either Facebook or Instagram. Look, we sell ads. That's how we make a living. And I've constantly worried about Facebook and Google just eating up the ad space, and now Amazon, because they have so much more information about the audience. We don't know anything about the audience. And I don't think Facebook's knowledge has gotten any worse thanks to Apple. I think that's a little bit of misdirection.
I think where it hurts Facebook, from what I understand, is tracking a purchase. So you get shown this great Instagram ad, and it pushes you off to a website, and Facebook no longer can tell if you are, if you actually like click buy.
Oh, wait a minute! You don't think so? Remember, Google was telling advertisers, oh, by the way, we can tell how many you sold because we got the credit card data as well. All of this stuff is sold to data brokers and sold on, isn't it? Don't they know everything anyway? Do you really think Facebook is in the dark about what you did?
Yeah, Facebook's payments features have been, they've always had trouble getting those kind of universally accepted. You know, I still don't see a lot of, like, even though in theory you can use your Facebook account, I think, to buy on some stores, I don't see a lot of merchants actually adopting that.
But I don't think you have to. I think that if you use a credit card, that information will filter back to Facebook.
Eventually, the merchant can link it up, but does Facebook know?
And if there's a like button or a Facebook bug of any kind on those pages, they know that you went there. I think Facebook.
But on mobile, that's a desktop feature, right? So on mobile, all those links get broken, and that's where Facebook's vulnerable.
Do they? The IDF, oh, the only thing that button on Apple does, by the way, is turn off the ID for advertisers so that that information, that unique code is not transmitted. But doesn't mean that Facebook doesn't see like buttons. Is that stopped by Safari? I know I use Firefox and it stops them. I don't know. Does Safari stop them?
Safari has a private-ish feature, right?
Yeah, I think it's that private.
Right.
I don't think that's that private. I think these days fingerprinting is so good. It's a safe assumption that what you're doing is pretty well known by everybody on the web, whether or not you click that button on the IDFA. In fact, there have been a number of research studies that back that up over the last 6 months. So, yeah, if you're running an ad blocker, but I don't think most people run ad blockers yet. I don't know. I think this is interesting. We'll see. Is it the beginning of the end for big tech? Now, government is making some inroads. Congress is moving pretty quickly on a number of fronts. They went out of committee. I'm blanking out Congress. That's good. That's a good thing. I can't remember her name. Our senator from Minnesota, her bill, Amy Klobuchar. Thank you. Yeah, her bill and I think it was Marsha Blackburn was a co-sponsor to force. And by the way, the bill was written with like a paragraph per company. It was very clear who they were aiming at: Google, Apple, to force these third-party app stores. And I think that may well pass at both the Senate and the House and go on to be law. There's also a very concerning bill that is back, the Earn It Act, which is a terrifying bill, which we beat once last summer. But Senator Dick Blumenthal and Lindsey Graham have reintroduced the bill. We beat it actually in 2020. That will, according to the EFF, pave the way for a massive new surveillance system run by private companies. Just in time. It would roll back some of the most... This is EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Apple, by the way, agrees. It would roll back some of the most important privacy and security features in technology. It's a framework for private actors to scan every message sent online. And the premise, of course... Think of the children. The premise is, of course, that we've got to stop CSAM, child sexual abuse material. And so companies need to be held responsible for every bit of traffic on their network. The Earn It Act could also ensure that anything hosted online, backups, websites, cloud photos is scanned. Remember the fight over Apple scanning stuff on your iPhone? Well, get ready. It also weakens encryption. And here's a scary thing about the Earn It Act. It has strong bipartisan support. This act matches a similar law that is in front of the House right now. The bill creates a 19-person federal commission. What could possibly go wrong? Which is mostly run by law enforcement agencies, which will lay out voluntary best practices for attacking the problem of online child abuse. The real concern from a lot of people is this will actually just force child abuse underground, where it will continue unabated, meanwhile leaving us in a much less secure and private state. So just a little be aware of CSAM. It also changes Section 230, which is a big issue. In fact, Mike Masnick, who's a big 230 supporter on Tech Dirt, had a number of pieces, I think three, talking about the dangers of the Earn It Act. Any thoughts, Dan Patterson, on Earn It?
I think anytime we talk about changing 230,
it's bad.
I can't tell you my opinions on policy, but I think weakening encryption, changing 230, bad.
Mike's headline in Tech Dirt is how the Earn It Act is significantly more dangerous than FOSTA. FOSTA, which did pass, he says Earn It repeats the basics of the FOSTA playbook. But, and this is very important, since Earnet appears to have significant momentum in Congress, it's significantly more dangerous in multiple different ways that necessarily haven't necessarily been highlighted.
I will say, you know, we can't lobby Facebook, we can't lobby Google, we can lobby the government. So if we find these policies noxious, lobby the government.
Yeah.
Or vote.
Yeah. Or vote, or both.
Or both.
Yeah. Actually, both might sounds pretty good right about now. All right.
I do find it interesting, Leo, that all of these laws, not just Earn It, but you know, there's another one about ending platform monopolies.
Yeah, that's they have the closure like, bill. Yeah,
they have these really arbitrary cutoffs. You know, like, oh, if you exceed $600 billion in market cap, then you know, then we're going to take away your Section 230.
Oh, it's totally aimed at big tech. Yeah,
right. Well, Facebook almost slipped below that. So, like, are they, you know, like on a Monday, are they going to be exempt from it? And on Tuesday, are they going to be subject to it?
That's
like,
interesting.
Have they thought about how any of this works?
Oh, that's you really know? Interesting.
And another one was like $600 billion in revenue or $600 billion in market cap. And I'm like, you at Congress don't understand the relationship between revenue
difference.
And market cap, do you?
No.
It said either or.
Even Walmart doesn't have $600 billion in revenue. So, it would apply to literally no one. I mean, these things do get worked out through the amendment process. And, like, you know, the most glaring kind of, you know, oopsies tend to get fixed. But yeah. I still think it's worth pointing out, like, you know, that's a big tell to me that, like, there's not sophisticated thinking about market structure going into these laws. And that's disturbing.
Yeah. Facebook is on the order of $100 billion a year revenue, something like that. Profit's pretty good, though, by the way. Don't worry about Facebook. Their profit is still in the $30 billion a quarter range. It's doing all right. Alphabet quarterly results came out as well, and Alphabet broke $200 billion in annual revenue for the first time. So Alphabet did not take this opportunity to blame Apple for anything. Mm-hmm. Missed opportunity there. For 2021, the full year, 41% year-over-year jump in revenue for Alphabet. Unbelievable. Fourth quarter revenue, $75.3 billion. That's up 32% year-over-year. Advertising revenue for the quarter, $61.25 billion. Apparently, Apple didn't hurt them. But I think Google, and I think Facebook's in the same boat, have plenty of ways to get information about you. Google.
And they have Android.
Yeah, they have Android. They have Chrome, which is the dominant browser. They have, you know, YouTube, and they have search. So you're sending them plenty of signals. YouTube adds $8.63 billion in revenue in the fourth quarter. Of course, there's always the other bets, which always it's always fun. Google makes so much money in search, and then they spend it all on Waymo and Verily. Other bets, $181 million in revenue, but I think a substantial loss. Cloud, a loss of $890 million. So, it's boring, isn't it? Who cares about money? I don't care about money. It's boring.
I care about money. No, money's awesome. You know? I'm team money.
I'll tell you, this is something... It's money related. It came from Google's quarterly results, but their Pixel phones had their best sales quarter ever, which probably isn't saying that much, given that they've not been huge sellers in general. Sundar Pichai in the earnings call said, in Q4, we set an all-time quarterly sales record in spite of an extremely challenging supply chain environment. I just got, speaking of supply chain, I ordered when the Pixel 6 came out, I ordered a Pixel 6. I got that pretty quickly. I ordered the case, which I just got yesterday, 4 months after I ordered it. But I got it. Thank God I didn't drop the phone in between now and then.
I think it's the first Google phone, just anecdotally, that I see in the wild routinely.
You see a lot of Pixel 6s?
I don't know about a lot, but I think on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Which I can't recall on any other Pixel phone. So, yeah. I mean.
They don't break out sales figures, so we just have to go by Pichai's claim that it's the largest yet. But, you know, double nothing is still nothing. It doesn't compare with the iPhone or Samsung's phones at all. All right, let me take a break. I'm going to find something that's going to get you excited. We could talk about Joe Rogan. How about that? I got to find something.
Good helping.
That's money.
No, it's not. It's not money. Well, it is, isn't it? Yeah. He's
$100
million guy. Yeah.
I just wanted to add on the point of Google making money hand over fist. About a decade ago, I had some free Google host. I own my own domain, deleon.org, spelled phonetically. And I had it hooked up to Google for Enterprise. I got one free email address hosted by Gmail, basically. Yes, exactly. I got an email like 2 weeks ago saying, oh, remember that free single email address we gave you a decade ago? Now we're going to charge you.
Yeah.
And it's like $7 a month for email. So I'm like, A, don't you make enough money, Google? And B, the only thing that email did, I'm obviously not paying $7 a month for email. I'm like George Costanza. I was like, you're not winning. So all I did was maybe figure out like an alternative hosting arrangement.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to go with iCloud or whatever because I already pay for that. But I'm like the greed of like how many people could have had that free, you know, is it a million? Almost certainly not. And you need an additional $7 a pop for the, like, it's just... It is. It was very disappointing, and it made me really question, like, do I really, like, what else don't I need from Google or from Amazon or from any of these guys? It's like that, like, just to make an extra, you know, couple dollars a month, I'm just reevaluating my entire relationship with all these guys. That's how I work, I guess.
No, I understand.
This is just the same thing.
One more thing that Google's switching off. So you had the one free email as well?
No, I was paying for Google services and got a very similar email saying they were raising the price on it. This was 2018. I did a story on it, just the process of quitting Google, how I quit Google services. It took my entire Thanksgiving week to put in prioritize what Google services are important. Oh, geez, there's all these photos backed up, and then to export everything, to kill everything. And I still have nagging Google services following me around. So it is a process. But I did just put everything on iCloud and Cloudflare. Anyway, Nick, the exact same mindset and process.
Yeah.
iCloud's
this
okay.
is not the, not Google managed. I want to point out, Dan, this is not your first rodeo. It's not the first time you've tried to quit Google. This is 2019.
That's a newer post of the same old story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've tried. I nuked Facebook services, and to do a story on Oculus, I had to start a Facebook account. I mean, it is incredibly hard. If you want to quit big tech, it's really hard. Sorry, Nick. I didn't mean to hijack.
It just sort of triggered my Consumer Reports finding the best deal. And I hope we talk about the Amazon Prime increase maybe later in the show, because that did a similar thing. I'm like, where's my money going? What services am I paying for? How do I min-max to put it in like World of Warcraft terms?
Exactly. Yes, right. Exactly.
Yeah, this is, yes, thank you.
So it's not money that's the problem. It just has to be the right topic of money. And we're going to get right down to it. Min-maxing your investment in Amazon Prime. Oish. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. We got a good panel. It's going to be fun. Dan Patterson's here from CBS. Just CBS. CBS News, right?
CBS News.
CBSNews.com.
/live.
/live. Got to get the slash. What happens if I don't do the /live? Be old stuff?
You still get news.
Yeah, you still get news. And there's a button on there that says live, so you can go live.
You can do that too.
Yeah. Okay. CBSNews.com/live.
It'd be better if it was not biz, but
it's great to see you. Also with us, Owen Thomas, great to have you from Protocol. He's a senior editor over there, long time friend, and always great to have you on. And kind of relatively new to the group, Nicholas De Leon, who's been on many times now. You're no longer the newbie, but it's great to have you.
That's okay.
Senior electronics reporter for Consumer Reports. Speaking of old times, I remember when Linode first started. Well, gosh, when was that? In the early 2000s. It was so cool. They were one of the first cloud infrastructure companies to offer SSDs running Linux. Man, it was awesome. Well, Linode is all grown up, man, and it is awesome. It's the industry's best price-to-performance value for all compute instances. Whatever you're doing, shared, dedicated, high memory, doing artificial intelligence, GPUs too. You get free DDoS protection, free cloud firewall, unfiltered API access, and more from Linode, L-I-N-O-D-E, the original. They started 3 years before AWS, and they're still famous for predictable flat fee pricing, universal across all 11 of their data centers. No weird tiering, no weird regions. You just choose Linode because it's the best. You get support better than any because the people who work at Linode are like us. They understand. They're there to help. The interaction's always great. People choose Linode who want a better customer support experience because they're independent and their mission is keep the customer happy. No matter what tier, no matter what level, no matter how much they spend, you are not a number to them. You are the reason they're there, the driving force behind everything they do. Their pricing is transparent. It's predictable. It's pay as you go. They really started predictable flat pricing for cloud computing. And they're still the leader in this. No more anxiety over hidden costs, weird egress fees, things like that. They make it simple to launch and scale in the cloud with Linode. Your flat pricing is the same across every global data center. You get an incredible cloud manager. It's very easy to use. There's a full-featured API, great documentation, award-winning support. And it's secure, it's proven, it's reliable. It's enterprise-grade infrastructure. I think that's the one thing. You know, because I've been on Linode so long, it's not a hobbyist thing. It is for me because, you know, I use it for projects and, you know, practicing coding, things like that. But it is enterprise-grade infrastructure, and so many people use it to run their apps, to run their sites, for backup, for CI/CD, for AI, for gaming services. Their peering relationships are extensive. They've been in this business a long time. They peer with everyone. Their next-generation network gives you the modern infrastructure and performance you need to innovate at scale. You could choose shared or dedicated compute instances. We're going to give you a $100 credit. You can use it on that. You can use it on S3 compatible object storage. Yes, that's nice because your S3 software will work with it. You already know how it works. Managed Kubernetes. Yes, they've got that. Virtual machines. As much power as you need or not. Linode was rated easiest to use by G2 Crowd in 2021. That's why cloud developers choose Linode because they make managing complex cloud infrastructure easy. Simple bundled pricing, full-featured API, 100% human support. They've been doing this for a long time, since 2003. So they've got the longevity you know. They know it. They've been in this business a long time. No hidden fees, scale up or down without penalty. And right now, get $100 credit when you go to linode.com/twit, linode.com/twit. I'm a big fan, using them for years. Linode, give it a try. And we thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. You support us too when you use that address, linode.com/twit. So what about it? We can do Amazon Prime. What about Amazon Prime? $20 bump, right, in a yearly fee.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes me mad because they say, well, we got to pass along costs. And it's like, well, wait a minute. What exactly am I paying for? Is it Prime Video? Is that why Amazon Prime's going up? Is it your rocket to the moon, Jeff? Is it your new yacht that they're going to dismantle a bridge in Holland for? What exactly am I paying for? I think the mistake of going up by that much, $140 a year, is that it does make people think about it and say, is it worth what I'm getting? What did you decide, Nicholas?
Yeah, well, I spent several hours, I guess the day after that was announced, kind of researching, you know, get the sentiment online. What are people feeling about this? You know, maybe or may not, we will do a story on reevaluating your relationship to all these companies. But I think the thing it triggered in people, like I said earlier, was that it just kind of like, what am I paying for? You know, $20 a year is less than $2 a month, which I'll say two things about, because I saw a lot of comments about this too. Oh, it's only $2. Okay, well, A, that's not the point. And B, you know, this is something that's drilled into me from being at Consumer Reports. It's like, people have budgets. Money does not grow on trees. Whether it's $2 or $2,000, people have money allocated that they spend every month. And for you to ask all of a sudden, well, here's an extra $2 a month. Okay, yeah, maybe most people can swing that, but maybe they can't. So that's one thing. And then when they try to justify it by saying, oh, well, we have the NFL on Thursdays. I don't know if there's a thing on this planet I care less about than the NFL.
I don't want to help pay for the NFL.
Right. I don't care. If the NFL disappears tomorrow, I'll be like, what are you even talking about? So that, and I suspect a lot of nerds are the same way. Like, this is not relevant to me in the slightest. Now, I will say, at the end of all of that, I did run the numbers, and what services am I paying for? Spotify and Cobuzz and Google One Storage. I did all the math. And as it turns out, for someone literally with my specific set of services, it does make sense to keep Prime. If anything else, it makes sense to go even further into the Amazon ecosystem, because I personally can save money by doing Prime and Amazon Music Unlimited, because they have the hi-fi that saves me from having to pay for Spotify or Cobuzz. They're very, very specific reasons, but it's the type of thing where it's like, you should go over with a fine-tooth comb, who are you giving money to every single month? I get the sense that a lot of consumers out there, $5 here, $5, they don't really think of it. But I'm here to tell you that stuff adds up. And all these little streaming services they want you to subscribe to watch the Flavor of the Month television show, which is invariably, who cares? It's great. Let's say it's great. Whatever. It's like, these things cost money, and money doesn't grow on trees. So I really do think that asking people, you know, a little more, it may just backfire, because I don't know that people are going to put up with it. It certainly is, you know, if you're a family never mind inflation, have you bought like a pound of chicken breast recently, or milk? Like, prices are going up very, very high. And now Prime wants more money. I don't know. I don't think it's a good look, especially given how much money Amazon made through the pandemic and through this recent quarter. Now they're like an advertising juggernaut. So you want an extra $2 a month out of me? Why don't you just, you know, it just smells fishy. So that's my.
It's also the case that Prime made sense when it was, because it was free second day shipping, when you would always get that. But a lot of times now you don't. And
no, so I will say, in the past year, I've had several packages delayed, just gone missing. The other day, I, you know, to give a very specific example, I bought Ghost of Tsushima PS5 game. I was supposed to get here Saturday. I was supposed to get here Friday. It arrived here today. Now, is that a big deal? No, obviously not. But the point is, I'm paying for Prime to get, right, you know, at most 2 days. So what am I paying for exactly?
This might be the wrong time to raise Prime, because, you know, maybe the shipping thing is because of COVID and it's going to get better.
Sure.
But, or supply chain, or whatever excuse you want to use.
Sure.
But this is now, and this is when you're raising it. By the way, Yahoo Finance, actually Bloomberg, pointed out that almost half, 52% of Amazon Prime members are monthly members. So they're going to $180 a year, which really makes you wonder, is it worth the money?
I would just advise folks to really look, you know, get a calculator and see where your money is going every month, because it may not be worth it, depending. And it may, you know, it may not be worth it if you just tweak your things a little. It's like, oh, well, if I shop over here, or if I tweak my shopping habits this way, you can make this so that it works for you. You don't have to be, you know, beholden to any willy nilly price increase. I do encourage folks to like take the time to look at this stuff, because it's important. And, you know, these companies, they don't care, I guess, even though they're making money hand over fist, you know, no one's looking out for you. So That's my rant with the Prime price.
And by the way, I am an NFL fan, and I actually would pay Amazon not to do Thursday Night Football. Keep it on CBS and ESPN. Amazon.
That was a huge request.
They do a terrible job.
A lot of folks were saying, can you just like maybe there needs to be two tiers of Prime service? One where it's just the Prime shipping as it used to be back in the day.
Yes.
And then one with like all Prime Plus called with all this other stuff. Okay, great. But a lot of folks are literally just here for the free 2-day shipping. And now Prime is like, all this value, all this stuff. It's like, well, I don't use this stuff. Why am I paying for it? People just get frustrated. And like, it's highly understandable.
The change goes into effect February 18th if you're a new subscriber. If you're an existing Prime subscriber, renew now. Because if you renew after March 25th, that's when it goes up. So if you can renew now, you'll save that $20. It's not about the $20. It's really about thinking about, well, what am I getting for what is now more than $10 a month? You know, that's a lot of money.
My question
what is bundled in there?
Oh, that's the other question. Who the hell knows? It's a lot of stuff.
Who's running Amazon PR? Like, how did anyone inside Amazon allow this to be rolled out as part of the earnings announcement?
Yeah. Yeah. And we made $141 billion this quarter. And oh, by the way, Amazon profits were $14.3 billion in the quarter. It's a $1 trillion company now. Oh, and by the way, we want more money from you.
So tone deaf. And think of all the union organizers who are going to say, look at how much money Amazon reported making, and they're raising the price on Prime. And what are they, what are they giving you?
Amazon's PR is not great. Remember how they fumbled the sidewalk announcement and got everybody to say, oh, I don't want that. Maybe they're not the most accomplished in the world.
They spend all this time fighting with reporters. Like there's actually a team that is devoted to, asking for corrections, whether or not a correction is merited. And if they, and they're not doing their job. They're not doing their job of like presenting a positive image of Amazon or like.
Is that a hangover from Bezos, who was pretty combative? I remember his ex, Mackenzie, writing a nasty review of the Amazon book, The Everything Store. Putting it on Amazon. I think Bezos is kind of combative. I wonder if Andy Jassy, the new CEO, will maybe tone that down a little bit. Here we are at tech journalists, so obviously we don't like it, but it's not a good look to get in fights with people who buy ink by the barrel, as they say. What do you get? I don't know. What do you get? You get maybe 2-day delivery, Prime Video, which is pretty good. Somebody in the chat room Captain J is saying, well, you should just drop your Netflix and that'll make up the difference. The problem is not everything's on Amazon Prime. There's stuff on Netflix that you want to see. I mean, in fact, Amazon Prime, of all of the streaming services, maybe if you like The Expanse, yeah, there's good stuff on there, I guess.
That was a big show that people like. They also do include, to their credit, currently, they include free unlimited photo storage.
You get that
was one of the reasons why I was like, okay, maybe I'll go all in on Amazon.
Now, do you get your music free? No, you still pay for your music with Amazon Prime.
They have Amazon Music, they have kind of like a thin tier that is free with
Prime. 2 million songs.
If you want the real service with 70 million songs and hi-fi, you have to pay for Music Unlimited, which if you have Prime is $7.99 a month, which is less than the $9.99 for Apple Music. Qobuz, which is a smaller service, which is hi-fi, that's like $12 a month. So it is, you also get like random magazines, the February issue of, I don't know, Business Week or like Food Network magazine, which is like, cool. I'm not opposed to that, but it just feels so random. And like, it's just on a website, like a list of like PDFs.
It's the same thing with the books. You get the Kindle Unlimited, but it's like, I don't know what kind of books are on there.
Right. You don't get Audible. You don't get Comixology.
No.
And they could have very easily lowered the price of Amazon Music Prime or rolled out, you're getting this much more, free tiers or we're boosting what's on Prime Video. Like they didn't package it with any benefit to the consumer.
I think this is
cancel my Prime.
See, I think this is a test. I think Amazon's curious. They know
maybe
that for some people, this will trigger an like Dan or Nicholas, a trigger a reexamination.
Yeah.
And they're curious, well, how many people, how price sensitive are people to these subscriptions? How far can we push in the Everything store? Or maybe it's his successor to that, Amazon Unbound. I think it's in the Everything store. Both books are great about Amazon. He talks about the pricing of Amazon Prime, and they had no idea what to charge. They just pulled the number out of thin air. They had no idea what it would cost them. There was actually a significant risk it would be a big money loser, that a two-day shipping would end up costing much more. Turned out to not be the case. It was a huge success. It's probably the most successful membership club since Costco.
This is a changing of norms, or at least pushing norms in a particular direction to test the boundaries.
That's what I think. Now, maybe I'm a cynical guy. I have read, it's Brad Stone, by the way, both of those books, which are fascinating studies in business and psychology. And a lot of what at least Jeff Bezos would do would be like that. Well, let's see what if we change it $20. Let's see what happens. See if Dan Patterson notices.
So, Leo, you're saying that they sat around in their Seattle headquarters and said, why don't we make this announcement as ham-handed a fashion as possible and see
if anybody notices.
Yeah.
That's why their PR is so defensive. They're like, damn it, I got to sell this?
How about Prime Day? That's pretty successful, and then that's probably a driver. Maybe that'll be the time to announce this, Prime Day. Instead of during your earnings call, I'm here on the Prime website on Amazon. I'm going to press explore my benefits. Here's a page that probably not many people go to. Free 2-day, free 1-day, free same day, free ultra fast grocery, prescription delivery, release date delivery, no rush shipping, Amazon Day. That's the one where you pick a day and all of your stuff comes on the same day.
Yeah.
I guess that eliminates truck emissions. Key by Amazon, where you give the driver your garage door key and they leave your package inside. Prime Video, Prime Video Channels, Amazon Music Prime. Discount on Amazon Music Unlimited. Prime Gaming. What's that?
I think you get free DLC for certain games, which is, that's my huge free time is gaming, but
Free in-game content.
It's not Luna, though, right?
No, something else.
No, Luna's separate, yeah.
Amazon Photos, which is a good deal. That's free, unlimited, well, not free, but included with membership, unlimited full-resolution photo storage. Google charges for that now.
Yeah.
Amazon Kids Plus. I'm not going to go through the whole list, but there's...
it's a lot of stuff.
The Whole Foods, savings. It's no longer whole paycheck if you have Prime.
See,
it's pretty substantial. So all they had to do was say oh, and by the way, we're going to give you $20 off $100 at Whole Foods for your first year to offset the increase, which they could easily have
done. I think they got that in their back pocket. They're saying, let's see what happens, and then if Dan Patterson quits, we're going to give you $20. Let's just see. Do you actually take out your phone and scan your Amazon Prime code when you're at whole paycheck?
I do.
Yeah, do you really?
Yeah.
I can't. I guess I should. Does it save you a lot
of money?
I do
the Amazon Go thing, too.
Do you?
You probably don't have those up in...
No, we don't have
up
them.
...up in the North Bay.
No. Yeah. All right. You also get Prime exclusive shipping benefits on Woot.
Amazon owns so many
things. They own everything.
They own fabric.com. Zappos. They own a lot
Zappos,
of random
e-commerce
sites.
You get free shipping, free upgraded shipping at Zappos. So, maybe this is I'm not going to quit because I'm, they're going to buy everything eventually, and I want to keep my membership.
There's also the Prime Visa card, which I do have, which, you know, it's 5% cash back and anything bought via Amazon.com. So I use that. And if you're not a Prime member, that drops to 3%. So I'm further incentivized to shop from Amazon,
you
which I
make your money.
I don't especially mind, to be honest. Yeah. But yeah, it's just like, where's my money going here? I don't, you know.
And if you had to, put it all together yourself, I think that might be hard to do. So, all right, I was trying to gin up consumer outrage, and instead we've just said, you know, it's a pretty good deal. Actually, I think I'll stay. I think I'll keep it.
I'm pretty sure the Journal wrote a story. Is Prime still worth it? The other day, it's got a lot of people are talking, and again, it's a fairly small price, $2 a month, not that big. But a lot of people are like, huh.
By the way,
what's going on here?
The Journal's conclusion: here's why it's still worth it.
There you go. We're all in the tank.
Tank for Jeff and all company. Yeah. By the way, the mayor of the Dutch city says we're not taking apart the bridge. Don't worry. You saw that story, Jeff Bezos's new yacht. Again, not a good look, Jeff. While you're raising Prime costs, Jeff Bezos' new yacht is so big that the shipyard where they make it said, you got to dismantle the bridge. I like Jalopnik's headline on this. Here's the boat that won't bring Jeff Bezos' hair or his wife back. Feel the secondhand shame. $540 million mega yacht, so big. It's built by a company in Holland called Oceano that it can't fit through the bridge. Although, again, I saw, I have to find that article, but I saw the article that said the mayor said, no, because he was getting a lot of pushback. We're not going to dismantle the historic bridge just for that yacht. All right. You guys are so quiet. I was expecting more feistiness over Prime. Let me see if I can find something that'll upset you. Something that'll get you mad. How about, I've been saving this, but I guess it's time to play the Rogan card.
Yeah, here we go.
It's interesting. Jon Stewart said, knock it off, everybody. Jon Stewart, leftist journalist, The Daily Show host. He's now got a show on Apple. Maybe it's because he's on Apple now. He can't be so. He says people should not call for Joe to be censored or canceled. I actually, believe it or not, I kind of agree. I don't want to see censorship. But boy, the hate fest continues. There's now a supercut of Joe Rogan using the N-word. Pretty old stuff. There's a video of him laughing hysterically while a fellow comic talks about sexual abuse. It feels like the guns and knives are out for Joe Rogan. Anyone have an opinion on that? Dan, you're a journalist. What should Spotify do about Joe Rogan? They are going to post a disclaimer, apparently.
Well, definitely journalists shouldn't advise on policy. However, nobody wants to be accused or engaged in censorship. But I think it's fair that if you say offensive things like the N-word repeatedly, or you have people who are pretty close to racists and Nazi sympathizers like the people he's had on, especially in the early days. I think if you have people like Sargon of Akkad who have said horrible things about women, I think if you advance a ton of mis and disinformation about COVID and vaccines, then it's okay for people to say that is offensive. And if you take $100 million, that means that Spotify owns you. You work for them. They're not a platform like Facebook. It's not analogous to Twitter or QAnon that we find offensive and maybe we want to get. It's not the same. He works for them. And it's fair for an employer to say, hey, we don't like you saying the N-word. We're taking the content down.
Spotify,
the culture war stuff, the whole censorship argument. I have no idea. Nobody wants to engage in censorship. I happen to think that maybe that's a little bit of a red herring and it's a distracting argument. It does not talk about the victims. What about people who don't like hearing the N-word because it's a really offensive term? What about the fact that misinformation at scale about vaccines is harmful? Talking about Joe Rogan, I think, focuses a conversation on Joe Rogan, and that's great. It's great for his attention, but it doesn't talk about the victims. And I don't ever want to be in a position where, like, censorship is bad. Yeah, sure, it's bad. But you know what? He's done some things that many people have been hurt by. And you know what? Let's maybe talk about those people and the fact that Spotify paid him $100 million to do that.
Yeah.
Also, censorship is done by governments.
Yes.
So Spotify is not a government.
No, there is an employer.
They say we don't own him. We are not his employer. We gave him $100 million so that he would be exclusive on our platform. But we do not own.
What's the difference?
Well, we don't own the show. We don't employ him. And somebody last week made the point, a good point. You knock Joe off Spotify, actually more people will hear him if he goes back to YouTube and plain old podcasting. Right now, as a Spotify exclusive, you have to listen through Spotify.
I think one big mental fix for thinking about these is to stop using the word platform. Like, do not allow it. Facebook is not a platform. It's a social network. Spotify is an internet broadcaster. Airbnb is a lodging marketplace. Uber is a ride-hailing service. Once you start calling things what they actually are, it really clarifies policy decisions.
That's a darn good point, Alan.
You know, it clarifies, like how we should view, actions. Like, you know, we view CBS as, you know, just to pick on Dan's employer, as responsible for what is broadcast on CBS.
Like, yeah, if Dan started spouting this, they'd fire him.
Look, you asked me my opinion at the very onset of the show. You asked me my opinions and about a topic I don't even remember now. But I squirmed a little bit because I had to.
You're not used to giving an opinion. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not my job to express opinions. Yeah. It's not my job.
That's so old-fashioned. I love it.
Well, I mean, look, it really isn't. I don't even think that that's old fashioned. I think that that harms the trust relationship I have with audiences.
I agree 100%. I don't mean old fashioned in a bad way. It's a good thing. I just
can't do my job. People can't trust me. And guess what? People don't trust Joe Rogan either. And now they don't trust Spotify.
Right. It's, you know,
and it's fair.
It's been a surprising pushback. I thought, you know, when Neil Young said, well, I want my music off, Spotify's reaction was probably like mine, like, well, fine, Neil, go ahead. Big deal. But actually, it's hurt them quite a bit. With the other artists, Nils Lofgren and Joni Mitchell, and podcasters saying, yeah, we don't want to be on this platform. It actually seems to have hurt them. There seems to be a movement to cancel Spotify memberships.
The funny thing is, a lot of musicians came forward saying, oh, yeah, we're going to take our stuff off of Spotify, too. And then they discovered, or someone reminded them, they sold off their publishing rights.
Whoops. It's not up to you.
Or some private equity firm.
Talk to ASCAP.
Yeah.
It's not up to you. Yeah.
I guess I would say I have a pretty, I don't know, I think a pretty interesting take on this. I've been listening to Rogan basically since day one. I used to listen to Howard Stern and Opie and Anthony as a young man. And Rogan was always on the time on the Opie and Anthony show. This is like 2005, 6, 7. So this is a very long time ago. Back in the day, he used to talk a lot about like ancient aliens and like exoplanets and like
was he kind of like, can I ask you, because I've never listened to the podcast. I'm somewhat familiar with him, but was he ever a stand-up? They call him a comedian. Yes. So he did do stand-up.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of specials. Yeah, he's a stand-up comedian.
Okay. And, so, you know, stand-up say all sorts of nutty things. And
sure.
It's understood. Yeah. It's comedy. I mean, you could still get canceled as a stand-up, God knows. But there's a certain understanding that you push the limits. Stern pushed the limits.
It's funny to see the Rogan debate pop up because I was actually part of a podcast a couple years ago where we analyzed it. It was called the Joe Rogan Experience. We had like four episodes. The problem was that man produces such a volume of content that it was impossible to listen and to like take notes on that stuff. So if anyone's been like listening closely to what this man has been saying for the length of his career, it's kind of been me. And I just wanted to add, you know, as
finally, we've got a Joe Rogan expert on the show.
I've also been racially abused in my life. It's not fun. I could think of there was one particular instance where I felt very, I'm obviously not going to get into it, but to have your personhood diminished because of the color of your skin is not fun. Having said that, as that person, I listened to his, you know, obviously you really can't defend the viral video that came out this weekend. That's indefensible, but like just some like spicy humor is like, I don't know. It's never bothered me. Is that my family background? I've been around this kind of content. You know, frankly, my family is a very blue collar family, a lot of law enforcement. It is not exactly as a waspy family that is offended by like words and stuff. So that, I don't know if like, you know, the elite media has a very similar background. But yeah, it is very interesting to see, like you said, the knives come out. I personally, as someone who has listened, I don't listen as much anymore, just because I can't stand the COVID talk. I'm over this.
Does he talk about COVID a lot now?
It's too much. It's like if you're hosting like a radio show, it's like, can we get onto another topic?
Yeah.
I do wish he would go back to, you know, like the aliens and like, you know, he had UFC fighters on. Like I like that stuff. I don't know. The focus of the show really seems to have fallen off with the move. And you know, it was great that you guys had the Spotify debate last week, because I was like, you know, if I'm Spotify, is this even worth the trouble anymore? Like, have people join Spotify Premium because Rogan is there? You know, they'll show growth, right? But would that growth have occurred anyway? Is he that big of a draw that it is worth the constant and relentless like news cycle, like focus on this man? I don't know that it is.
Ultimately, this is probably good for him, right? More people know about him and probably more people are listening.
And the idea, and I also think it's kind of funny, let's say Spotify says, you know what, this is actually not worth our trouble. Goodbye, Rogan. There's some clause in the contract where they sever the relationship. Are people going to, like, his mega fans, are they going to all of a sudden start reading like the Atlantic, or are they going to like, that's not happening. No. So like, I kind of don't understand, you know, I don't think you should be saying fake things about the vaccine. Like, obviously I'm not a fool, but like the idea that the people listening to this are all of a sudden going to be listening to Edward R. Murrow or whatever is like, that seems fanciful and fake. I don't think that's going to happen. And I kind of think that maybe that bothers folks that this meathead who is a commentator on MMA has such a reach and influence. Maybe that bothers people. I don't know. But yeah, that's sort of my take. As a one-time fan of this guy, I wish he would kind of get away from this stuff because it's exhausting and it is not fun. It's just not a fun, you know, let's get back to ancient civilizations, and that type of thing. Cause that was, as a young man, that was interesting talk. And he doesn't do that as much anymore.
I listen to Stern too, and sometimes it's offensive. Sometimes it's like, I can't believe you're talking about this, but you can turn it off. And, I guess the big issue is if he's giving advice to people who believe it about health, which where he has no expertise, or he's having pseudo experts on, and people are listening to it and not getting and actually risking their lives because of it, is what then what do you do? Because I'm not for shutting people's voices down. I think we just have to rely.
Yeah,
on
I think he acknowledged in one of his. He's done a couple apology videos in the past week or so. I think in one of them, he said, like, yeah, maybe we should step away from this. Maybe I should be better informed. I think he know it's kind of, you know, obviously I don't know him. I was a fan from way back. It feels like the show has gotten out of control. It has gotten so big that maybe like the power has gone. This was a show again. This was a show he was live streaming from like his basement, right, or whatever, talking
success
about like Cahokia.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, he's so big and it's so powerful. You got that rush of like, you know, people wanting to deplatform him. He's his fans. egging him on. When
everything has to, everything has to become that, doesn't it, these days?
Well, I think that's the challenge here. I don't like the polarized conversation. I don't think anybody does, but I think it's fair to like. I listened to Rogan for a long time too. In 2017 and 2018, I heard really offensive stuff about women and about people of color. And I stopped listening because I heard a lot of offensive stuff. I don't recall thinking this guy should be canceled. What I did is dial out. And I think that there is a nuanced conversation that can be had here. I agree that maybe nobody is going to stop listening to Joe Rogan and start reading The Atlantic. But I think that it is fair to say, I find this offensive. And I find that the profit from that to also be offensive. And that's fair and fine to say. I don't think that dismissing that is helpful.
Yeah. Well, and just to give you some ammunition here, according to The Verge, who talked to an ad buyer who wished to be anonymous, it's $1 million an ad to get an ad on the Joe Rogan Experience. It is absolutely a moneymaker. That money does go to Joe, of course, but Spotify sells the ads, so it's part of the Spotify ad network. So it is very good for Spotify's business. Whether they'll make $100 million in a year or two, I don't know, but there's no question it's added to their subscriber base, and they make good money on the advertisements.
Yeah, and it's also, to me, it's like there's clearly a demand for this talk. It's like it feels like one of the, like the unspoken. He's so popular. Let's
Spotify doesn't release numbers, but Joe says 11 million listeners per episode.
I don't
know if I credit that, but that's a lot.
That's a huge number of people who are listening to this guy who are not consuming other forms of media.
Right.
And I think it's like, why are people attracted to this? Is it, I don't know. Those are like interesting media questions.
Don't comics often ask this though? Isn't this kind of a common discussion among comics? What is my responsibility as you become huge? Do I change my act? Do I change my shtick, or do I stick with what I'm doing? What's my responsibility now that I have a large audience?
Have to be a comic to ask those questions. I came from radio. I remember Stern. I'm a journalist. I ask myself those questions all the time. You can be a normal person and ask yourself, what's my responsibility to the culture and society in which I live, especially if I'm profiting from something? I don't think this has... I agree with a lot of what we're talking about here, but I don't like the... let's wrap this in comedy. Let's wrap this in I'm just an entertainer. Those all seem like easy excuses for not taking responsibility. And I mean, do and say what you want. That's fine. But you don't get an out just because you're a comedian. I don't get an out for being a journalist.
No.
And
you still have some responsibility. Yeah. And he does, let's face it, he sells vitamins and stuff. I mean, he has maybe some incentive to say, well, you just need these immune pills instead of a COVID vaccine, which would be reprehensible if he's profiting from misinformation. There are those who say, in fact, there's an Atlantic article from a couple of years ago that Joe Rogan is so popular because he understands men in America better than most people do, and we should be paying attention. It's no surprise it's two young guys who listen to Rogan a lot. Did he speak?
I certainly did a lot when I was young. I'm 36
Did he speak
now,
to you as a young guy, as a young man? It was like he's...
I mean, more than like, you know, barons or so, something like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Nicholas, I found the same content. I mean, I think a lot of people use the YouTube discovery engine when I would be editing a story or something. It was fairly... I could listen to something else. Definitely, I wanted to hear about spaceships, and I wanted to hear maybe a talk with the guy from Tool, and I wanted to hear Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's when you bundle that in with the Sargon of Akkad's or he had some... maybe I shouldn't name names, but he had some people who have fairly reprehensible beliefs on, and he platformed them. He amplified them. And I think that there's a responsibility there. I'm not saying, oh, let's cancel Pitchforks, but I'm saying that maybe there should be a responsibility, and wrapping it in comedy seems like an easy out.
Yeah,
sure. But as a listener, as a listener, I don't know who Sargon, like, If I'm listening to this, it's like I'm not into it. I'm going to turn it off. If he's interviewing, you know, Michael Bisping of the UFC, I'm probably going to listen to that. Like you said earlier, it's like if I'm not into that, I could tune out of it. You know, if there's a controversial comedian coming to the local, you know, Chuckle Hut, I don't have to go. His fans will go. Does everybody like that comedian? Probably not. But if the man has fans and they go and they pay and they I don't necessarily have like an ideological problem with that, I guess.
And for advertisers, you know, they might object to some of the content, but they're looking at it from the perspective of, you know, these are people who are probably not going to watch CNN,
exactly.
Probably not going to listen to
it. It's a valuable audience. Yeah.
They are hard to reach.
Yeah.
And Spotify sells, you know, packages of ads where, like, if you want to buy Joe Rogan, you have to buy other ads
mm-hmm.
on the Spotify network. So mm-hmm. it's more than just the 100 million, more than just the 250 million.
Yeah.
You know.
All right, let's take a little break. I'm sorry to bring up the Joe Rogan thing. I just wanted to get
sorry, just wanted to piss
people off.
You're not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. Not at all. Our show today brought to you by Podium. You know, text messaging is the best way to talk to your customers. That's how they want to hear from you. They don't want you to call them. Who wants junk mail? Who wants email? We want text messages. If you own a business, there just aren't enough hours in a day to waste playing phone tag. The list of customers you need to reach doesn't get any shorter, especially when business is good. That's why local businesses everywhere turn to Podium. 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 P-O-D-I-U-M. Makes every interaction as easy as sending a text. So everything that makes your business great can get done faster. I'm noticing more and more businesses around me are using Podium. My dentist, when I leave, says, leave a review. I love it. They send me my appointment. So I just click it and it's added to my calendar. You can collect payments with Podium. You can market to your customers. The ice cream store in town sends me a coupon. It's the worst thing ever. Every few weeks, we miss you. Here's a coupon for 30% off ice cream. No! Podium does it. It works. They make it all as easy as pressing send, and you won't just free up more time. You'll grow your business. You'll get more done. With Podium, you'll close deals with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. Yeah, a lot of times that's how you can get a job, issue a quote. People text you, you text them back. Podium makes it easy with a single inbox. Your employees will like it. Your customers will love it. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free. Podium.com/twit. Or sign up for a paid Podium account and you'll get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. That's Podium, podium.com/twit. Thank you, Podium, for your support of This Week in Tech. Podium.com/twit. What do you think? Is the pandemic coming to a close? Are we up? I feel like it's all over. It's over. Go home. Go out of your home. Go to work. Stop working at home. Dan, do you feel that? Do you feel that sudden, like, you know, I'm watching a football game and there's 100,000 people without masks just sitting cheering and everything?
Huh.
No?
I don't know. I'm in New York and it definitely doesn't feel like it's
no.
over.
But you guys are shell-shocked. You got PTSD. I mean, you've had two big surges.
There were maybe fewer people. Omicron was felt December and early January felt a lot like March 2020.
I
was supposed to go to the office tomorrow, but we're just going to do remote hit. So I don't know. I mean, I think we were supposed to be back in the office in January and then so who knows? I don't think that this doesn't feel over to me, but,
I'm in Hudson Valley, so let's call it 2 hours north of New York City, and it's not over up here. But I was visiting a friend in the city the other day. It is over-ish up here. You know, masks, people wearing masks, and so, our county executive said he was not going to enforce the New York State mask requirement. So it's kind of weird, but it feels like it's. Maybe winding down a little bit. I'll give some slight insight. CR, we have been working from home since March of 2020. I have not been back to the office in Yonkers since March of 2020. I may actually go back in a month or two. We're testing.
Do you miss it? Game, do you want to go game. Back?
No. Do I miss the office?
Nobody wants to go back. Yeah.
No. It's a nice office, too. It's the nicest office I've ever worked in, as a matter of fact. But I've had the most productive years in my life as a worker bee working for any organization over the past 2 years. So I don't know, but... Who knows?
I mean, there's going to be a lot of news because we're going to hit a million deaths, you know, that's for sure. And there's going to be a lot of news about that. But as it starts, I don't know. What do you think? I just feel a lightning. And at the same time, I notice I'm not uncomfortable wearing a mask. So I might still wear a mask all the time. I don't know. What do you think, Owen?
You know, San Francisco has been kind of, we've been pretty far out there in terms of, masking. Like the Bay Area, as you know, was one of the first areas to shelter in place voluntarily before the state went right. to shelter in place. So it feels like overall we've handled it really well. You know, the continued weird thing is that, speaking here from downtown, ironically in an office, is that many employers are, have gone remote first, or they've postponed yet again a return to office.
I think that might be one of the reasons it's not over is we've kind of normalized this way of life and we like it. And I think people are traveling like crazy. The TSA numbers are really back to normal. People are flying, they're traveling, they're going places, but I think a lot of people don't want to go back to the office. And so that may not happen. I don't know.
I mean, even for certain jobs, like my job, I'm basically in Google Docs and on the phone or on Zoom all day. That is basically,
so you don't
my
need to be in the
job.
Office.
I could do that from Jupiter. It doesn't necessarily matter. Yeah. You know, a decade ago or more than a decade ago when I was at TechCrunch, I was also working from home. You know, TechCrunch had offices in San Francisco and New York at the time. And I would go into the New York office every now and then, but I would work from home, and it was not, I wasn't building Toyotas. I was writing articles in Google Docs and talking on the phone to people. So it's like, does my job, if I'm a business owner, do I need an office with X many seats? If I could just have the folks work from home, why am I going to pay for that office space? So I guess we'll see. I agree. I think that one of the bigger things coming out of the pandemic will be people's relationship to their jobs and what is my labor good for? And do I need to be in any specific place to do this? Obviously, if you have, my brother is a forklift driver in a warehouse. He cannot do that remotely. He's been going to the office this whole time. I'm different. So it does sort of depend on what you do, I guess.
How does he feel about the pandemic and so forth? How is he's had to work?
He's had to work. I'm reluctant to give his true opinion. It's a slightly spicy opinion. I think he would say something along the lines of, people who are so lucky to work from home don't talk to me type of thing.
I don't blame him at all for that. I mean, there's so many people who had to go to work regardless.
Yeah, he's a little younger. He's 26. And so, he'll see articles online where they're like, oh, going back to the office, should we? And he just shakes his head in so many words, and he's like, whatever, bro, whatever. He doesn't have a lot of time for or a lot of sympathy for people in my position, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I don't blame him.
I mean, I'm recording a podcast from our office because it's just more convenient. You know, I don't have to worry about someone ringing the doorbell. We live in a relatively small San Francisco apartment.
Have you been to a movie theater?
No, and one of our favorite theaters, one where my husband and I saw so many movies, just closed on Thursday, the Embarcadero Center.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, great, great little movie theater.
Closed forever.
Closed, as far as we know, forever.
Wow.
Possible someone might reopen it as a theater, but. It's hard for that category of like art house theater. Is that something you really want to leave your house and, go into a crowd of people for? I mean, I think we'll be dealing with like the psychological reverberations of this for.
I'm telling you,
for years.
PTSD. We're going to be the COVID generation C. Because, yeah, we're like the Depression survivors who didn't want to spend a dime. You know, we all know them, our elders. We're going to be, you know, our grandkids will say, why does Grandpa wear a mask everywhere? It's very interesting. I haven't been to a movie theater since it started. Or a concert. Oh, no, I have been to concerts, actually. That's interesting. I it's neither here nor there. I just, when we were talking about Joe Rogan, I thought, well, I wonder what everybody thinks as we... I feel like the light at the end of the tunnel. Is that reasonable? And it could be an oncoming
yeah, I think if you look at a lot of European countries are winding down restrictions. So there's that trucker thing in Canada, the guys demand like that. It feels like it is beginning. Yeah, I think light at the end of the tunnel feels okay, but then who knows? My adopted mother is like has a PhD in biology, and she's like, you have no idea, like a snap of a finger, there could be another variant that's like
there could
a
be
big one or whatever.
There could be, yeah. We don't know.
And I think to your point of the psychological, it's the uncertainty and the constant yo-yoing back and forth. Oh, it's over. Oh, it's not. Oh, that's just,
we're done.
Even for me, I've been lucky enough to be working from home. It is a real blow psychologically. Yeah,
yeah. I think we're done with that.
Can someone explain to me the trucker protest? Because aren't truckers like alone in the cab? How are they affected?
Did you see that they raised? It turned out it really was out of the U.S. and a lot of the money raised in GoFundMes was really political fundraising. In effect, GoFundMe is actually frozen. Almost $10 million saying, you know, this is Fox News even says, promoted Capitol Hill occupied protest appeal. I don't know what that means. But Dan, are you doing any reporting on the Canadian trucker protest?
None.
A lot of Trump flags in the group. I don't think they can vote for Trump in Canada. I might be wrong.
The only thing I was going to add is that I'm not doing any reporting on a Canadian trucker protest, but the GoFundMe shutdown reminded me of, I'm sure you remember Leo and Owen too, and probably you too, WikiLeaks way back in the day. I guess it was like 2010 when like PayPal and Visa shut them down, and then they started asking for donations in Bitcoin, and it's just the idea of you know not casting any sort of judgment on this protest, but the idea of like a fundraising scheme being shut down by a centralized authority was like one of the great like selling points of crypto back in the day. It's like, this routes around that damage. You don't even have to deal with centralized authorities anymore. So that's really what this thing reminded me of more than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I don't really know much. It's interesting how little we know. If you lived in Ottawa, you would know. You would care. It'd be a big deal for you. This, you know, the Freedom Convoy is overwhelming Ottawa, apparently. But I think it's mostly American truckers, which is one reason probably Canadians aren't real thrilled by the whole thing. How about this article from a guy named Owen Thomas, still in Protocol. Silicon Valley loves mafias, and you should too. What's that? What's that? What's your premise here, Mr. Thomas?
So there was this this guy named Ryan Breslow who co-founded a payment startup called Bolt, and he went on Twitter to say that Stripe, you know, which is kind of the big up and coming player in payment processing, and Y Combinator, which is a startup accelerator that helped Stripe get its start, were acting like mob bosses, and you know that they had actively tried to prevent his business from getting off the ground.
You could not attack two more beloved entities in Silicon Valley than Stripe and Y Combinator. I mean, if anybody's beloved in Silicon Valley, it's these two companies. Y Combinator is a I should mention, is a kind of a startup camp where you can go, you get a little bit of an investment, you get a lot of education, a lot of learning. A lot of companies have come out of Y Combinator, And of course, as you mentioned, Stripe is the leader in payments processing.
Airbnb, Dropbox, you know, a lot of companies you've heard of got their start here. And Stripe is, you know, Stripe is well regarded because they made tools that are really easy for developers to integrate into, you know, their websites, their software, their apps.
Mention that we use Stripe and they are a sponsor. So, okay, go ahead.
Full disclosure.
So it doesn't affect how we cover it, obviously, but yeah.
So I thought it was interesting. Breslow was, you know, playing on this idea that there are these like networks in Silicon Valley. They're often called mafias. That's probably why you use the term mob bosses, you know, the PayPal mafia. But there's also a Facebook mafia, which just means a bunch of alumni from Facebook who went and started companies after they left Facebook.
And this is history. You point out that that's how Intel was started, or actually Fairchild was started.
Yeah, the whole history of Silicon Valley is groups of employees meeting at one company and leaving to start another.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Breslow is saying, well, this, you know, the system got kind of broken because like he wanted to bust in and start his company. Well, Bolt started 3 years after Stripe. So, you know, his complaint is that Stripe had lined up all of the great startup investors. Well, it's considered really bad form if you're a venture capitalist to invest in a direct competitor.
Yeah.
So they don't generally do that. So I didn't really get what his complaint was there. And then he also had like, these other theories that that Hacker News, which is this website that Y Combinator operates, it's, you know, Reddit like, you know, upvoting and downvoting links.
I live on Hacker News. I love Hacker News. Yeah.
You know, so he claimed that when Bolt had some announcement that his announcement got downvoted and Stripe had a similar announcement that got upvoted. And the editor of Hacker News, or moderator, went on to explain, well, Bolt's post was very, you know, commercial and kind of, you know, advertisement-like, and people tend to downvote that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
this guy sounds, I would have just said, oh, he's just a whiny loser, except for the fact that he's worth the company's worth $11 billion, actually about to raise for $14 billion.
I know. It's like if Stripe and Y Combinator are mob bosses, they are the most inept mafiosi you've ever met.
Yeah.
But I did think it was an interesting discussion to be had about like these networks of people that kind of make Silicon Valley run. And, you know, are they always to the good? Something I didn't get into in the piece is that there is a problem with mafias, which is that, you know, they tend to perpetuate a lack of diversity. Like if you have a group of mostly young white men at, say, PayPal, and they go and start companies, they have a tendency to pull that same not very diverse network with them. Now, it happens that, you know, at PayPal, there were actually a lot of women, too, who went and started companies, played key roles, became investors. For some reason, they get written out of the history of the PayPal mafia. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But, you know, I think there are critiques to be made of mafias, of alumni networks, of these connections. But Breslow did not make them.
It's a story as old as time. By the way, Breslow stepped down as CEO after this. So the story that's old as time is, one, people getting in trouble on Twitter. It's never, ever a good thing to get spicy on Twitter. But two, that's how it's always worked. When I was in college, I went to a prestige university because that's where you make the connections. And the people who really wanted to be prestigious would join the secret society where you'd really make the connections. But that's 100 years old. It's probably as old as humanity. And in fact, for a long time was the kind of the sung as the praises of San Francisco and Silicon Valley is, well, you know, that's where you're going to have these serendipitous interactions with other people who are working and you'll share information. And that's the value of it. I'd be hard to stop that. Yes, diversity would be nice. So maybe work on that. But then they can
be part of the... That's not the critique he made. You know, he wanted to be part of of this, you know, old boys.
I wanted to join, but they wouldn't let me.
And, you know, and again, like, his company's been very successful. You know, it's just, it felt a little sour grapes. And, you know, on the other hand, we're all talking about Bolt now.
Yeah, it was good marketing.
It wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even on the radar before.
You know what's
so
good?
Maybe he won.
You know what's good marketing is to please your girlfriend by writing a word game and then selling it for seven figures to the New York Times. That's good marketing. I'm talking, of course, about Wordle. I had to laugh, though. Anderson Cooper wants to do it. He's a big Wordle fan, wants to do a story of Wordle. Does he invite Patrick Wardle, the creator of Wordle, onto CNN? No, he invites Monica Lewinsky on to talk about how much she likes Wordle. That's what's wrong. That's why I'm only going to watch CBSNews.com/live from now on, because you guys would never, ever do that. Do you play Wordle, anybody? John, you playing it? All right. None of these guys play Wordle. Are you actively avoiding it? Have you never heard of it? Or
I'm actively avoiding it. Yeah. I saw people on Twitter talking about it, and like, this is one of my red lines for me. I'm like, I'm not.
He hates it. He says all the people sharing their Wordle on there has ruined
Twitter. I'm happy for them. Yeah. I hope they have a great day, but
It's stopped, by the way. It seems to have stopped. It doesn't, happen anymore.
I think Monica Lewinsky, by the way, has had like this incredible second act.
Renaissance?
And good on her for like not letting what a man did to her define.
Oh no, it's great.
Define who she is.
It's great. It's just, this is kind of, unfortunately, the celebrity mindset of, I guess, of CNN. I would invite the programmer on to talk about it. But,
well, Jeff Zucker isn't there to make those decisions.
No, he's gone. And apparently Lewinsky is writing for The Atlantic and wrote a story about Wordle in The Atlantic. So that's the, there's a real natural tie in there.
But I think that, I think that the fact that the New York Times, splashed out, I understand, like, what, low seven figures?
They said seven figures. I've got to figure it's low, which means a $1 million, but still good on Patrick, right?
Yeah.
But I think that also tells you how, you know, like how important games are to the New York Times strategy. And we're talking word games, crosswords, of course, as, you know, being kind of the iconic offering from the New York Times. But, you know, it just goes to show you that, you know, just like pumping more URLs out into the internet is not necessarily the answer to, to internet media's problems.
By the way, I want to correct myself. And if Anderson Cooper had invited Patrick Wardle on, he would have gotten the wrong guy. It's Josh Wardle. Patrick Wardle is also a programmer well known from the Mac world. Josh Wardle, who invented Wordle, he's a nice Welsh guy who invented it for his girlfriend during lockdown, and is now making some low seven figure money for it, which is good. And it's smart. It's very smart of the New York Times to scoop that up, right? Because they have word games already, and you want that word of mouth. You want that attention, don't you?
Speaking of bundled subscriptions, that is the future of the Times, right?
Times has done very well with that.
Very smart.
Very well. I pay for cooking, crosswords. In fact, my biggest problem with the New York Times, I can't get them to stop delivering the newspaper. I don't want the newspaper. I just want the other stuff. And I can't figure out, maybe somebody could tell me, how do you subscribe to the digital-only version of the New York Times? I've narrowed it down to just the Sunday Times, but I don't want it. I can read it online 2 or 3 days ahead of time.
The Times also just recently bought The Athletic, that sports website, which is amazing. If you're into like sports writing, like in-depth report, it's
really good. They deserve that.
I've subscribed Brady's Paisley since day one.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That. All right. Let's talk about Apple. They have responded to Dutch regulators who said, you've got to allow, for some reason, Dutch dating apps to have their own in-app purchases. This is one of many places like South Korea and perhaps soon the U.S. where Apple is being forced to give up their app store, their 30% VIG. So the Apple's response was, okay, we'll give you your own app store and you'll only owe us 27% commission because we're not doing the payments processing anymore. And the response from the community is amazing. Stephen Trotton Smith, who's an Apple developer, absolutely, this is on Twitter, absolutely vile, his response. He says, this says everything about Tim Cook's Apple and what it thinks of developers. I hope the company gets exactly what it deserves. Everybody on the executive team should be ashamed, and some of them should not be here when it's all over. We all see you. Marco Arment, who, of course, is a well-known developer and for iOS. His Overcast is a very popular podcast player. He also worked at Tumblr. He wrote, you can just feel how much Apple despises having to do any of this. And by the way, if you're a developer, they've made it so there's absolutely no way you're going to do this because once you pay the 3% to your credit card company and you still pay Apple 27%, and there's a lot of hoops you have to jump through. You have to have a dedicated app just for it, special app. You have to do all sorts of paperwork. It's just, I think it's fascinating that Apple is willing just to go balls to the wall, excuse me, testicles to the wall for this. Like, dudes, you don't read the room. This is not what people are talking about here.
I think what it says is that the App Store commission is only marginally about payments. It's about marketing.
Right.
It's about marketing. It's about distribution. It's about, you know, discoverability in the App Store. It's about the, the SDK, all the tools that you get as a developer to build your app.
So you're defending Apple. You think Apple's right?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's capitalism. Like, this is the cost of doing business.
We created this beautiful platform, and we're going to do all the hard work if you want to sell apps here, but you're going to give us 30%, which is less than, Ingram microcharged when I was when you were selling software in a box, they would take 50 or more percent.
Yeah. Now, and actually in the Fortnite case, if I recall the judge's decision correctly, they actually found that, maybe there's a case to be made that Fortnite shouldn't have to use Apple's payment system, but that doesn't get Fortnite out of the 30% commission. So like, fine, go ahead, use a different payment system and you're going to have to pay Apple 30%. That was where, if I recall again, the judge's decision correctly, where that was heading.
Judge got overturned by the Ninth District, by the way. And they said, yeah, no, Apple, you don't have to do that.
And, it is complicated. I mean, I think pulling apart the payments, it is conceptually interesting to pull apart the payments processing part of things from distribution, from marketing, but it's always been kind of a package deal that, like, this is what you get for the 30%. Now, is 30% the right price for every app, for every market, for every situation? Probably not, but...
No, and Apple's even admitted that. They offer 15% for some subscription services and so forth.
Right, like after the first year,
Yeah. By the way, for the second time on this show, I have to apologize. I inferred that the phrase balls to the wall had to do with male genitalia. In fact, it has to do with a game, Dodgeball. So I just edit that all out. Go ahead. I don't care. Anybody wants to talk now. I'm humiliated. I'm going home.
Well, we're just going to take a 30%, 30%
take a third of that, will you? Yeah, take a third of that. Please be my guest. I don't know. I feel like Apple, So there is a certain amount of rent seeking in what Apple's doing. When they say to Amazon, your Kindle app, you've got to give us 30% of books you sell there. Or Netflix, you've got to give us 30% of your subscriptions. Or Spotify. And yeah, they cut it to 15%. But that seems like rent seeking. They didn't. That's not why people subscribe to Netflix, is because you made an iPhone or Spotify or buy books on Kindle because you made an iPhone. That's not. Apple doesn't participate in that success and shouldn't. On the other hand, if you make a Wordle on the iPhone and they're distributing it and they're promoting it, yeah, maybe that should be 30%. That's not an unfair amount. So I don't know.
It gets hard though to make an exception here and an exception there. Like you want to have consistent rules, and I think that's where Apple, besides the rent seeking, which I think is absolutely a fair critique, I think Apple also wants to have a consistent approach.
Yeah.
I think consistency though has been the challenge. I've spoken with big developers like Facebook and Amazon, but I've also spoken with very small developers, including a review site. They reviewed iOS indie games, and their contention is they used the term rent seeking and that they were essentially put out of business. And they argued that Apple is not evenly applying their rules, and that they would go after companies that appeared to mimic or do some things that Apple did, but better. And they were a little resentful, but I can understand how maybe the rules weren't evenly applied and that has generated some pretty ill will.
Yeah.
And the pandemic made some things weird because you had, like Airbnb had these things called experiences. Like you go stay at an Airbnb and you take a pottery class. Well, Airbnb figured, now people aren't staying there, but the potter still wants to have students, so we'll sell a Zoom pottery class. All of a sudden, Apple is saying that's a virtual experience, and our in-app purchasing applies to that. Whereas, they didn't charge 30% on the Airbnb stay or the pottery class before.
Let's take a little break. I'm going to charge you all 30% for this next commercial. I hope you don't mind. The bill is in the mail. I wonder, by the way, what the Dutch regulators are going to do, because Apple's clearly like going, yeah, okay, well, yeah, how do you like this? I have a feeling that the Dutch regulators might have something to say about it. We'll watch carefully. Our show today brought to you by Our Crowd. This is a really interesting idea for people who, and I want to emphasize this, you're saving up for retirement, you're doing all the right things, but maybe you're kind of watching all this excitement happen in Silicon Valley, all this money being made. You say, I kind of like to participate in this exciting world of startups. Here's the problem. You're not getting the information. You're not getting access to these companies at the right time. Once they go public, you can buy stock, but that's already after the exit. What you want to do is get in as the big investors do on the ground floor at the beginning, so that when the exit comes, you can benefit from that. And that's what Our Crowd does. Our Crowd is a venture capital firm that has what we call deal flow. They know about what's going on in those little startup garages around the world. They analyze companies, look at the ones with the greatest growth potential, and then let you get involved. From personalized medicine to cybersecurity to proton therapy, this is something new, a $20 billion total addressable market. In state-of-the-art labs and startup garages and everywhere in between, Our Crowd is identifying innovators so you can invest when the growth potential is the greatest at the beginning. And it works. Our Crowd accredited investors have already invested over $1 billion in growing tech companies. 21 of their portfolio companies are unicorns. Many of Our Crowd's members have benefited from over 40 IPOs or sale exits of portfolio companies. It is the fastest growing venture capital investment community. Let me explain a little bit about how it works. When you go to ourcrowd.com/twit, and please go there so they know you saw it here, you'll tell them what country you're in. And there are rules in every country. in the U.S., they call it an accredited investor, a certain amount of net worth, certain amount of experience. They don't want you to be, you know, betting the rent money here. But if you're an accredited investor, you can, and again, depends on which country you're in, what those rules are. So go there and sign up. It's free to sign up, by the way, and get deal flow and find out what's going on. It costs you nothing. But once you see something you like, you can get in a single company deal for as little as $10,000. We're not talking millions of dollars, just 10 grand. Or get into one of their funds for $50,000. But there is, and now you should know this, a minimum of $10,000 required to invest. But those terms, again, may vary depending on where you invest. So when you go to the site, input the country you're investing from. I'll give you an example, though, of some of the early stage startups you can get involved in. Right now, you can invest in something called HIL, Applied Medical. They're using Nobel Prize-winning technology to bring the most advanced radiotherapy treatment to cancer patients. It's the world's first laser-based system that's earned them an agreement with Proton International, the largest proton therapy operator in the U.S. and Europe. Oh, interesting. So they're already kind of getting into gear, HIL Applied Medical. But find out more. You can invest in that and or many other portfolio companies at OURCROWD.com/twit. But it costs you nothing to join, to find out more, to read the prospectuses, to read the information, to follow what our crowd is doing. It's really fascinating. OURCROWD.com/twit. I'm not an investor, but I find it fascinating to read up on this stuff. And I think it's a really good idea to give people access to stuff that normally only people down there on Sand Hill Road get access to. Join the fastest growing venture capital investment community, ourcrowd.com/twit, OURCROWD.com/twit. Let's see. Tesla's going to recall a whole bunch of cars because it turns out this is a great story. They even said this when they talked about full self-driving, that it would run some stop signs. Well, now, technically, that's illegal. We call it here a California stop in California. I don't know what you call it in the Hudson River Valley, but it's called a California stop here. And the way Tesla did it, I understand how the engineers are thinking. The Tesla, it says, looks at the intersection. There's nobody there. This is what you would do, right? And instead of coming to an energy inefficient full stop and start, it says, I'm going to go through at up to 5.6 miles an hour, 9 kilometers per hour. Okay, here's the bad news. It's against the law. But I also understand exactly why Tesla did it. Now, you're a consumer reporter, Nicholas.
Oh, boy.
What do you think?
Well, I will preface this by saying I don't know a ton about cars. So we'll say that. I'm not actually involved in the car team at Consumer Reports. But I would say I'm in favor of laws and following them. Like you said, I could see the engineering mind being like, well, technically, this is more efficient. Sure, but like there are rules of the road for a reason. So I actually don't know how I feel about this.
The Governor's Highway Safety Association says it is not aware of any state where a rolling stop is legal. But I bet you in Montana, come on now. Come on, man. You get to an intersection. You're in the middle of nowhere. You can hear the tumbleweeds blowing. There's nobody in sight for miles. You're not going to stop at that stop sign. You might slow down like the Tesla would, but you're not going to stop.
Maybe I'm like a very like weird. I stop at stop signs. Even though I'm a fairly rural area.
Do you come to a full
blink.
Stop?
I do actually, and I blink when there's literally nobody. I'm turning right. I put my blinker on. I don't know if I'm just
you're
like
a good boy. You're a good boy.
I'm a goody two shoes on the road. I don't know.
Tesla will have to recall a whole. I think it was something like 58,000 vehicles. There will be a over-the-air software update to turn this off. Tesla agreed to the recall after two meetings with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Tesla did say, well, there haven't been any, we don't know of any crashes or injuries caused by this feature. Model S sedans and X SUVs from 2016 through 2022, Model 3s from 2017 to 2022, Model Ys 20 through 2022. I think it's almost everything. everything that was capable of it. The firmware update will go out in early February, which makes me wonder why they have to do the recall. Maybe that's what's going to fix it. I don't know.
I was going to ask, what does a recall even mean in the age?
If you could software update, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like fix the software problem. It doesn't excuse, you know, Tesla for allowing this to, you know, get out there in the first place. But I do wonder if, you know, we kind of have to rethink the whole system of recalls, because that's an enormous amount of expense to get, you know, get the cars back to, you know, a service center and, you know, and for what? For an over-the-air update that, you know, you could get with the car just sitting in the garage?
Yeah. I wonder if it's just, I mean, this is totally speculation, but I wonder if using that language, recall, is just smart PR. It's language that we all understand. And
yeah, because it's really not, they say recall, and maybe that's the legal term. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
But it's recall documents posted Tuesday by U.S. safety regulators, I'm reading from the AP, say that Tesla will disable the feature with an over-the-internet software update by sometime this month. Now, I had read it was 2 kilometers, but it is 5.6 miles an hour. So it is pretty fast going through there. And AP interviewed a professor at Carnegie Mellon. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering. He said, four-way stop signs are commonly placed. We have them all over in California. Commonly placed to protect intersections for kids when no crossing guard is present. He said Tesla's machine learning system can mistakenly identify objects. What happens when FSD decides a child crossing the street is not relevant and fails to stop? This is an unsafe behavior and should never have been put in vehicles. I guess I agree. By the way, I do not do rolling stops. I have family members who do. but I like to stop. It's a token stop. I don't like sit there for a second. I come to a full stop, right? And I look around. And you should do the same. Otherwise, get your firmware updated. So, wow. Has anybody purchased any Bored Apes? Wow.
No.
You know,
no.
Around the time I started at Protocol, we actually had to come up with a policy around
NFTs. Yeah.
You know, and we had a policy around cryptocurrency and, you know, and whether you could hold it and disclosures that were needed. But we struggled to figure out with NFTs, like, if you have an NFT, like, does that give you a financial motivation to promote that group of NFTs or like NFTs in general?
Yeah.
Like, what's it, you know, or if it's really unique, then, you know, it's just your, you know, it's just, a, you know, like owning a piece of art doesn't give you a motive to like pump the whole art world, right? Like, you just think that your piece of art is, you know, is nice and worth whatever you paid for it.
Well, tell that to Paris Hilton and Jimmy Fallon. This clip on Twitter from a recent Tonight Show.
I know, I heard. I'm so happy I taught you what they were.
You did. You taught me what's up, and then I bought an ape.
I got an ape, too, because I saw you on the show with Beeple, and you said you got a MoonPay, so I went and I copied you and did the same thing.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
And
this
they
is
have,
your, this that's is your my, ape. Yeah, we debuted.
That's
really cool.
Paris paid, are you ready? $300,000 for that Bored Ape. Jimmy Fallon's Bored Ape, apparently $216,000, because what you do is you go back through the blockchain. And at the same time as he said, I bought one, there was this transaction for the ape that, you know, he has. So that's $500,000 on, by the way, you don't get the one and only copy of this art. What do you get? You could say I own it, and you get a URL, and that's it. And it is, I think, if you're going to, I mean, maybe I'm cynical, but if you're going to spend $216,000 on that, it's not because you love it so much that it's, or that you're so infinitely rich that it's like small change. It's that you hope to sell it on to somebody else for $316,000, right? It's an investment. It's speculation. So then to go on a Tonight Show, by the way, 7 million people have seen that clip on Twitter alone. I don't know how many millions have seen it on the Tonight Show, and say, look, that sounds vaguely unethical. Am I wrong? See, to me, it's now, I don't know. Anybody wants to defend NFTs, please do, or Bitcoin or crypto or Web3. But I am increasingly of the opinion that it's all a scam.
I think it's you should disclose. I mean,
Well, they said they owned it.
Yeah, yeah. I do work for my organization, so I'm promoting my organization. Publishing a story tomorrow morning. Interview, a short story, but an interview with Tim O'Reilly, you know, a famous publisher and technologist. He coined the phrase Web 2.0. I think Tim had the first or one of the first commercial websites. And he uses really strong language about NFTs and crypto. We have some video that we'll publish, but I don't know if he uses the word scam.
Wow.
But he references the trading back and forth of NFTs, which is pretty common to boost their value. And he does call it a pyramid scheme, or that it's like a pyramid scheme. He was pretty okay with the technology, you know, the underlying
blockchain technology. Fascinating.
Blockchain. Yeah. Right. But the use of it, look, O'Reilly knows his stuff and he's a trusted person.
He has, I think he has a blockchain conference. So he has a lot of conferences.
He has a lot of conferences.
I think he had a blockchain conference. So he's not against blockchain.
He's not a fool. Yeah.
He's not against blockchain. I think I really liked him a lot.
I don't think he's against crypto or NFTs. I think he is smartly pointing out the behavior around these products. I don't know that I would call an NFT or cryptocurrency actually technology. These are products that come from blockchain technology, but that these products have pretty scam-like behavior around them. And if you go to the very top of, I won't get into the pyramid scheme stuff, but it really, some of the behavior seems to be pretty similar to it.
It did strike me that a lot of people who were buying NFTs early on were people who are very heavily invested in crypto. Now, if you convert your crypto to fiat currency, that generates a transaction that that may or may not get reported to the IRS, but the IRS is definitely going to be interested in. When you convert your crypto to an NFT, not as clear to me that there is a taxable transaction that at least that the IRS can kind of pin down. I kind of wonder if there is some of that motivation of this is basically a way we can get our value out of crypto and, out of a fungible cryptocurrency and into this non-fungible token. There's also a ton of wash trading, basically meaning trading like for like, which when it happens with stocks is pretty suspect. So I think we have to look at that pretty carefully in the NFT market.
Well, and as Dan pointed out, there's evidence now that people are buying their own NFTs to get the price up to kind of stimulate some interest in the NFT.
I think Fortune magazine published a story. It's not my reporting. It's, yeah. I think Fortune's.
BuzzFeed has discovered the guys behind the board chimps, the BAYC, the Bored Apes Yacht Club. And it's interesting. They've attempted to be pretty anonymous, although they've now confirmed that they are in fact the creators of this. A couple of liberal arts majors, writers, journalists. And they lived in Florida and they thought, we should do this. They're not even the artists, by the way. They thought they were both in their 30s, met while growing up in Florida, according to BuzzFeed, and both had literary aspirations. They both were interested in crypto, wanted to create some sort of NFT collection, came up with the concept of rich apes living in a swamp clubhouse. So they hired a freelance illustrator to draw them, partnered with two engineers as co-founders to execute the collection, and they've been selling them. This is where you get the profit is. They make money not just from the initial sale, because remember, they didn't sell it direct to Jimmy Fallon or to Paris Hilton. Probably somebody bought it and sold it and bought it and sold it and it eventually got to them. They made $2 million from the initial sales of the NFTs, but they get a 2.5% royalty on all future trades. So every time that NFT is sold, they get 2.5%. So there is some money in this. I don't think they're scammers necessarily. I don't think anybody's a scammer in this exactly. But I think you should consider the source when you hear people pumping up the notions of NFTs or crypto or Web3, because they may have a vested interest in pumping it. Go ahead.
The whole point is we did not know who these two co-founders of Bored Ape Yacht Club even were until Katie...
They were anonymous. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, did that great reporting in BuzzFeed to uncover their identities. And she's gotten tons of criticism. People are saying it's doxing.
She's doxed them? Reporting. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just reporting.
Yeah.
But
no, and it's appropriate because for accountability reasons, I think people should know who this is that's doing this. It's
one there is in the crypto culture this, sort of like in the gaming world, this idea that you have pseudonyms and that you have some form of anonymity.
Yeah. Right. I mean, well, that's the whole point of blockchain, isn't it? Is that there's no central authority and everything's recorded in the blockchain, but it's not recorded with your real name. It's recorded with your account number or your pseudonym or whatever it is you're using to identify your holdings.
But someone actually used the blockchain to discover that a big crypto project was being run by someone who had been involved in a previous scam.
Yeah.
And they did all of that, you know, through blockchain analysis.
Well, and that's how people like Mark Cuban defend it in Katie's article, saying, well, look, this is all out in the public because it's in the blockchain. Everybody can inspect the blockchain. And you don't have to know their real name. You know their blockchain reputation. It's an interesting point.
Here's what Tim said, just a short quote. When I hear a lot of people say, oh, there's so much money going into this, it must be valuable and therefore it's going to be successful. I actually have the opposite reaction when there's so much money going into it. And then he quotes the famous Upton Sinclair line, it's hard to convince a man of something when he's invested in it. I'm paraphrasing there, but we'll post the whole video tomorrow. His point was him seeing the first web bubble come and go, the technology, the underlying framework of the internet, of course, was technologically sound. But the products that were built on top of it had so much FUD around them, or so much hype around them that it caused this bubble, and a lot of people got hurt in that bubble. And that's the underlying thing of what Tim is saying, is that the tech is one thing, the hype is another thing, and that if this bubble pops, people could get hurt.
Yeah. I can't wait. I will listen to that or watch that story tomorrow. That sounds really
interesting. I look forward to reading that, Dan, because that sort of like jives with my, like, the tech is very interesting as you know, people hear. It feels a little hypey. It feels a little, if Paris Hilton is on Jimmy Fallon, like, look at this, like that, my spidey sense is tingling a little bit there. Yeah. But I will say it's also interesting to see companies continue to like experiment. Like UFC just launched a bunch of NFTs last week or 2 weeks ago. They're very similar to the NBA Top Shot stuff.
Top Shots.
But on the other hand, EA said again a week or two ago that blockchain is not something they're actively pursuing. You know, after the previous quarter, they said they were pursuing. I would like to like just fast forward like maybe 5 years to see where all this is this just flavor of the month? Just like every marketer at an org is like, we got to get involved in NFTs because the kids are into it. And it just ends up being nothing. It feels, again, the tech is super cool to me, but it feels like this particular implement, like I'm super not impressed with like ape pictures on Twitter. Like, I'm sorry. Like, that's not like, I don't know. Like even if you have the octagonal, like, oh, cause you pay for Twitter Blue and you've what? No,
I just made an octagonal profile picture and used it, and that's fine. I don't.
But on the other hand, if people get if they feel it like does something for them and they feel cool by having that, I also have no problem with that either. But it does feel a little hypey and a little A little weird, I guess, as it currently exists.
Reed Max, Max Reed is his name. Reed Max is his Substack. Actually did a little digging, and it's kind of interesting, the inner relationships. Jimmy Fallon is represented by CAA, which is, by the way, an investor in OpenSea, which is the number one NFT marketplace, and also is representing NFT collector 0xb1, who owns NFTs from the Bored Ape Yacht Club. And another CAA client, Ashton Kutcher, also an investor in OpenSea. Kutcher is starring in a Netflix movie with Reese Witherspoon, who owns the World of Women NFTs, who happens to be married to a CAA agent. I think it can get a little bit crazy. In fact, he's got one of those crazy maps that you tie the strings from here to there and everything like that. And I'm sure it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but it is kind of interesting how this, and I have, you know, these things happen in Hollywood and elsewhere in other communities where they these trends burn through and everybody's, oh, I got to get one. And just, you know, I feel like maybe people should be cautious. That's all. Just if it's money you don't need, go ahead. But there seems like there might be other things you could do that would be more useful. Boy, I'm wondering what Google's intentions are with Stadia. It seems like it's slowly winding down while everybody else with their streaming gaming systems is just getting started. Stadia has apparently killed their white label version. Business Insider.
That was the business.
Yeah, I thought it was. Well, it wasn't initially, but then they pivoted. Anyway, just another buyer beware, I guess. And speaking of buyers,
why does Google need to be in all of these lines of business? I mean,
yeah, maybe not. You know, maybe. No? I mean, I think their mode of operation is, we'll just try everything, and you know, and kill it the minute it's not a good idea or not profitable, and that gives us a better chance of finding the next big thing than a company like Apple, which is saying, well, let's spend $100 billion on self-driving vehicles, and maybe that'll be the next big thing. I think Google's a little bit more like, let's let 1,000 flowers bloom. But there's a downside to it, which is that people who use Google services start to get a little worried that their favorite's going to disappear too.
I think one of the issues with Stadia was always kind of the specific business model. It wasn't quite the Netflix of game, like compared to Game Pass.
You had to buy the game.
Yeah.
You had to buy the game so that it never actually made sense. Like as a consumer, like, why would I do this? Again, compared to Microsoft Game Pass, where it's like, oh, that's part
that
of my $15
a
month.
Yeah.
It's bundled. Like I play on my phone or stream on my laptop. That's kind of cool. I've used Game Pass streaming. It works fine. You know, I happen to have a decent internet connection. Of course, that's kind of like, you know, that's the trick, right? If your internet is good enough or not. But yeah, Stadia, I don't know. It had a weird, how they structured that always felt wrong, basically.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. And then we'll wrap up with a few shorties, little quickies. We got a great panel. I'm so glad to have Dan Patterson here, CBSNews.com/live. And we'll look for your interview with Tim tomorrow. I think Tim is a smart guy, really interesting. I can't wait to hear what he has to say about all of this. At Dan Patterson on the Twitter, do you have a special super secret drop for people who want to give you tips or anything like that?
No, just proton mail or email.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. That's all you need. Owen Thomas from Protocol, senior editor over there, doing great. Boy, I love Protocol. Give our regards to Megan. Megan Maroney's over there.
Absolutely.
Now. Yeah. Anything you're working on you want to talk about?
Actually, speaking of money, I have a disquisition on the stock market dropping tomorrow in Protocol source code. So
good. Can't wait.
I'll try to make sense of it all.
So you kind of have a newsletter.
I do. My day job is senior editor of Protocol FinTech, which is now a daily newsletter. We're really excited about that, 5 days a week. And occasionally they let me out of my cage and write for Source Code, which is the flagship newsletter over here.
Nice. Very nice. I always enjoy your writing. I enjoy reading your writing, but not writing your reading because I don't write anything. I hate writing. Also with us, speaking of writers, He is the senior technology or electronics reporter for Consumer Reports, Nicholas De Leon. Great to have you, Nicholas.
Thank you,
Leo. What are you working on?
It's funny. I'm actually working on a crypto thing now for CR that should be published, within the month, maybe. It's kind of a tricky thing to do. If I could publish a side project, then I have a podcast. We talk about wristwatches, Seiko and Rolex news called The Hour Time Show. Just a fun thing for give me something non-tech related during the week to opine about. So The Hour Time Show.
Is it H-O-U-R or O-U-R?
Yes. H-O-U-R.
Like the hours of Hour Time Show. Wristwatch review.
Yeah, it's just a fun little side thing.
What are you sporting these days? What's on your wrist?
I actually have on today. I just got this from my brother. I am not quite in Rolex money quite yet, but this is an Orient Bambino. Where's my camera? Kind of a fun little.
I love wristwatches.
Yeah.
You know, it's sad because I only wear an Apple Watch now because of I don't know why. But I love wristwatches. Kevin Rose, of course, bought a Hodinkee.
I had a story in Hodinkee in December about how the Apple Watch like was my gateway drug, so to speak,
into knowing about it.
I had no idea. I didn't know watches existed, frankly, until I got the Apple Watch and was using it. And was like, it kind of like got the gear spinning or whatever. I have the article in Hodinkee going into that. I wear the Apple Watch nowadays mostly just for like fitness stuff or like cycling or working out or whatever. It is nice to not have the constant like buzzing of messages and WhatsApp and all that stuff. Just the time is good enough for me. So
Kevin has so much more money than I do. He doesn't. He's wearing these most amazing, beautiful, $100,000 wristwatches. And that's my problem with this. I love wristwatches. I think they're beautiful. But I'm more of a Timex guy than a, Patek Philippe guy. But I wish I had, at the same time, the idea of having something worth $100,000 on your wrist, that just seems unconscionable to me. So I don't know. I actually shouldn't say that that's how much Kevin's watches cost, but we did go to a dinner with him at the French Laundry that was sponsored by some high-end Swiss watchmaker. And they had a guy there with little magnifying glasses on, a little hammer, and he was building watches and filing stuff down. It was like wild. These things are handmade. It's amazing.
Yeah, I had an editor in New York City about a decade ago who, he would hold up a picture of the magazine and in the back there was invariably like a Rolex or Omega ad, and he was like, Rolex pays for all of your salaries. And as like a 25-year-old, I was like, oh yeah, I guess I'm a rank and file. What do I know? Those watch companies spend money. Very interesting.
Big money.
Interesting. Anyway.
Someday. But I can listen to the Hour Time Show and I can get my watch fix. I have a, Lisa gave me, and it's a beautiful Cartier tank watch, which is a kind of very classic, beautiful watch. Again, she always says, why aren't you wearing your tank watch? I said, I can't watch. It would look dopey to have two watches.
That's a debate in the watch. Can you double wrist? No. Schwarzkopf did back in the day, if I'm not
Norman
mistaken.
Norman Schwarzkopf?
Yeah. Norman Schwarzkopf.
Norman? Double watched. Yeah, yeah. He probably had one that was Iraq time, and
I don't remember.
Was US time.
There's a couple photos of him. But that is a debate in the community, because then it's like, okay, then I'll wear the Apple Watch and then like a real watch.
So, I've been thinking I could probably wear the Apple Watch around my ankle. It would probably work.
I haven't tried it. CR hasn't tested it, so I don't know.
Test it, would you? Our show today brought to you by Nureva. Nureva, you've got the huddle room, the conference room, the big one where you have people come in and stuff. And maybe you've looked at, how can we get the audio better? You probably had the speakerphone on the table, right? That's terrible. That's the worst experience ever. How can we get the audio better? So maybe you went and you talked to, a big audio technical firm, and they said, we got to bring the designers in and we got to spec it out, measure everything, we got to do some echo testing and stuff like that, and then we got to get the mics And they got to put them on the table when you got to tape them a mark where they are. And oh, by the way, because of COVID protocols, you got to sanitize in between meetings, and there's going to be wires and there's speakers. And we got a technician in there every few weeks because he's got to calibrate it. This is not what you want. But I have a better solution. A leap in technology that has transformed conference rooms. It's called Nureva, N-U-R-E-V-A. It's as simple as a sound bar. You could install it yourself. No wires, no microphones, just their patented microphone mist technology. The microphones are in the sound bar, but they work so there are no dead zones, that it's as if there are thousands of microphones filling the room, virtual microphones. You can hear everyone everywhere, no matter what way they're facing, no matter how they're social distancing. You could just talk and move naturally, and you'll be heard by everybody, the remote participants. It's amazing. It's got continuous auto calibration. So there's, you know, your room is always ready to use with optimized audio. You don't need an outside technician. You can install it yourself. It's a 30-minute DIY job. Just hang, if you can hang a sound bar, a couple of screws, and boom, you're in. You can do Nureva, which is going to save you a lot of time. And if you have multiple rooms, you'll use the Nureva console, which is awesome, to manage the rooms. Gives your IT department the power to monitor, manage, adjust systems from anywhere. They don't even have to go to the room. They can just do it all from the console. Nureva is brilliant. It sounds great. It works, saves you thousands of dollars. It's simple. It's modern. Ask yourself, you want to go with that costly, complicated, traditional system, or do you want to make the leap to simple, economical Nureva? Nureva.com. Find out more. It really is a brilliant solution. And as we get back to work, as we start having those meetings, some people are remote, some people are in office, you're going to really want to have this in your conference room. Nureva.com. Nureva.com. We had a great week on Twit. We have prepared a small mini movie for your enjoyment.
Like, we don't actually know if the Pixel 6 is their best-selling Pixel device yet.
It's too heavy.
And it's too premium, Miss Stacy. It's premium, not heavy.
Yes. It's too heavy for my delicate floppy wrists. Look. Just damaged me forever.
I'm not the grumpy one today. Two of you grumpy like crazy.
Wow.
I'm not grumpy.
Previously on Twit. Tech News Weekly.
There's the real estate market, and then there's the virtual real estate market.
An upland is basically a Monopoly game. So instead of using a traditional game board, they use maps of real cities where you can then buy and trade. I just put in my own address. And turns out that somebody had bought the address of my property in this game a couple months ago and was now renting it out.
This Week in Enterprise Tech.
PC Mag started answering the big question. What is the difference between VoIP and UCaaS, which is Unified Communications as a Service? The bottom line really is the definitions are not real clear.
All about Android.
The Samsung Galaxy S21 FE. Always, as I recommend, make sure you have a case on them. Despite it being made out of plastic or glastic, I recommend you have a case on it. And more importantly, supporting Big Mockadile.
Twit.
This is the year. Big tech is out. Yes. Big Mockadile is in.
We should mention, by the way, speaking of Samsung, we will be covering Samsung's event this Wednesday. It is 10 a.m. Eastern, 7 a.m. Pacific, so I'm making Jason Howell do it. He will come in, and you can watch Samsung. It's expected they'll announce the S22, and probably a stylus and maybe some other things as well. So Samsung Unpacked, Wednesday, February 9th, 10 a.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. GMT, 7 a.m. Pacific time. And watch our live stream of that. And, of course, as with all of our live news streams, you can then watch it after the fact on the Twit feed. If you don't like ads on this show or any show, you can watch them also on your ad-free feed as a member of Club Twit. I hope you are a member. If you're not, $7 a month gets you ad-free versions of all of our shows. You're paying us, so we don't have to advertise to you. We don't have to do anything. So get that. You also get access to the Discord, which is always fun. We have a really nice community in there. And Twit Plus Feed, which has not only some of the shows we don't put on the air, it has material that's before and after each show that we don't make a podcast out of. It has some unusual shows like our Entitled Linux show, which is getting its own feed, Stacy's Book Club, which is monthly and is really fun, The Giz Fizz with Dick D. Bartolo, and we just launched This Week in Space Club. Twit members will get to hear that first because we want to give them a chance to start the show in a friendly environment, so it'll appear only on Club Twit at first, but eventually, of course, we hope to make it a public show, our newest show. And we can do that, by the way, it's an audio-only show, thanks to members of the club. So please, if you're not yet a member, help us do what we do best, which is make great content for you by going to twit.tv/clubtwit. All right, one more thing. As long as I'm haranguing you, we also want to encourage you to take our Twit audience survey. I said we don't track you. We don't. But from time to time, we like to get to know our audience a little bit better. Advertisers want to know. Of course, it helps us develop content more to your liking. It's our annual survey. Once a year, go to twit.tv/survey22 for the 2022 survey. Shouldn't take you more than a minute or two. And it really helps us. And of course, it's completely voluntary. So you don't have to answer any question. You can skip them. You can not take the quiz at all. But if you do want to help a little bit, it's a great way to do that. twit.tv/survey22. South Korea hacked him. So he DDoSed the whole country. Hermit Kingdom, he's a U.S. security researcher. And apparently he found out that the North Koreans, did I say South Korea? I did. I meant North Korea. There's somewhat of a difference. North Korea had hacked him and other, I guess his handle is P4X, gone after him and other Western security researchers trying to steal their hacking tools, find out what they knew about software vulnerabilities. He says he managed to prevent them from taking anything of value, but he was so upset by North Korean state-sponsored hackers targeting him personally and by the lack of any visible response from the U.S. government. He said, this is an article from Wired, Andy Greenberg writing, of course. He said, after a year of simmering, he said, I'm going to take matter into my own hands. It felt like the right thing to do here. If they don't see we have teeth, it's just going to keep coming. So he said he looked into it, found numerous known but unpatched vulnerabilities in North Korea's systems. They, for instance, a known bug in Nginx that mishandles certain HTTP headers. He found ancient, his word, versions of Apache. he started to examine North Korea's own national operating system, the Red Star OS, which he described as an old and likely vulnerable version of Linux. He was able to single-handedly launch a denial of service. I don't know why I'm laughing, but I think I'm laughing because it's great. Single-handedly launched a denial of service attack on the entire nation, partly because they only have a handful of routers connected to the global internet. He said he largely automated his attacks, periodically running scripts that enumerated the systems still online and launching exploits to take them down. For me, says P4X, it's like a small to medium-sized pen test. It's pretty easy, interesting how easy it was to actually have some effect there. And so I don't think he took it down for very long. I think, as I remember, it was just a few hours. But totally took the nation of North Korea offline.
Cyber is asymmetrical.
Yeah. Wow. What a story, huh?
That's what's scary to me because, you know, if you look at the situation in, you know, in Ukraine and Russia, I mean, yeah, Russia, we see from satellite images that Russia is moving all of this military equipment and troops mm-hmm. in. What we don't see is what Russia might be lining up in the cyber realm or what Ukraine might be preparing as a, you know, as an asymmetrical response.
Yeah.
That's kind of...
Other security researchers have also said, maybe you don't want to mess with it because maybe we have stuff going on that you might interrupt. So maybe just, you know, it's not the right way to go.
Oh,
Yeah. You know, in other words, you don't want them to suddenly harden their systems.
Law enforcement's always going to say that.
Yeah, that's true. I like this story. And I don't like this story. BlackBerry has decided to sell all its patents to a non-practicing entity. Kids, we know what that means, right? Non-practicing entity. $600 million. I can't blame them. That's a good amount of money. They sold it to Catapult IP Innovations, which doesn't make anything or do anything. In fact, it was created specifically to buy these assets. So they brought in, I guess, investors. BlackBerry gets $450 million in cash, a promissory note for $150 million. What does Catapult IP get? The right to sue. And so I think you're going to see, that's judgmental. The right to charge royalties and then sue if they don't get paid.
I'm surprised that, you know, Google, Microsoft, Apple, like, you know, why wasn't there a consortium of industry players who came out and, you know, made a decent market clearing bid for.
It's a good, Google's done that before, actually. They've bought up old patents and said, Motorola. We're not going to, we're going to indemnify everybody. We're not going to assert these patents. Go ahead, have at it. Should we say shame on you, BlackBerry, or maybe we should wait and see? We'll see.
If you think about it, the patents were going to be with a non-practicing entity one way or another, because BlackBerry is way out of
the, yeah, they don't do it. Yeah.
The mobile business.
Yeah. They actually had licensed some of these technologies, so there's money to be made on it. Maybe it's just a license. Maybe it's just they're going to make money on licensing. Maybe that's it. I shouldn't assume. But I agree with you, Owen. It would have been a smart thing to do for Microsoft, Apple, Google, companies that make devices that use these patents to maybe just get together and buy them up. Let's see. North Korea. I think I've covered everything. U.S. The House anyway, has passed a bill to invest in chip manufacturing R&D. This is the America Competes Act of 2022. The Senate passed something similar last summer, the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. So the bills will have to be reconciled. The House version includes $52 billion in funding to help semiconductor companies build new factories to fund research and development. The president says he will sign that as soon as it comes to his desk. So this is probably a good thing. It's a direct way to address the chip shortage and encourage new factories to open in the U.S.
It is, but I mean, on the scale of time that it takes to build a factory, is that really
going to take a while? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think it is fascinating, though, the ongoing chip shortage. Often it's not the most cutting edge chips. It's these older chips that, you know, get embedded and, you know, do really simple functions like, you know, roll your window up or down in a car. And the fact that we're having shortages in those is telling.
Yeah, actually, a good article in Business Insider. Car companies stand to make billions by charging you monthly fees for adding features like heated seats, unless they can't get the heated seats in. General Motors actually stopped putting heated seats in some of their vehicles because they couldn't get the chips.
Right, because you need like a temperature, you know, you need a thermometer basically to make sure that the heat doesn't get, you know, too high.
Yeah.
And it's all of those little sensors, all of those little electromechanical, you know, features that you don't really think about. A lot of manufacturers have taken the approach of like, okay, you're not getting power steering in your car.
We in our Twit community forums, twit.community, I got a great message from Cortex_M0, because we were talking about this and these legacy nodes and the heated seats. And he wanted to address this because we've also talked about how much Samsung's spending $17 billion to build factories. Intel's spending $20 billion to build factories in Ohio. We've talked about how the big chip guys are stepping up, TSMC. He said there's also significant investment in additional fabrication capacity for legacy nodes. TI is making a huge investment. Three new fabs under construction in the United States, one due to be online this year, one next. However, he says every vendor I hear from, I guess he must work in this industry, says their backlogs have no end in sight. The CEO of Swiss-based ST Microelectronics told analysts last week his company had about 40% more orders than projected capacity for 2022, 40% more than they can make. That's despite ST bringing on whole new fabrication plants in Lombardy, Italy. Also despite the fact that he said in January that his company was sold out for the year. Other companies which have recently opened fabs include Infineon in Austria and Bosch in Dresden. I'm not sure if these are operating at capacity yet or if they're running at low capacity while setting up tooling and qualifications. Thank you, Cortex, for that extra information. So, yes, it is often these older chips, but there's a response to that as well. So, but it may not be till maybe next year. Maybe next year. Guys, I'm going to let you go. It's been a blast. I hope you have a wonderful week. I thank you so much for joining us. Nicholas De Leon from Consumer Reports. He's their senior electronics reporter. It's funny that you mentioned you're going to do something on crypto because I felt like this morning on the radio show, I spent about 10 minutes just trying to explain blockchain, NFTs, and Web3.
Yeah.
So that people, because people hear this, and I don't know, I think even for me, it took me a while to even understand what's going on.
That's one of the hardest part of this article. I don't want to give too much away about the article stuff, but like just explaining all this like cockamamie stuff, magic internet money imagine, you know, it's easy enough to talk to like people who deal with tech every day, but like for CR, it is like the most mainstream audience, like right. In publishing.
Right. And you don't really, you don't want to say to them, you know, even your dollar bill is made up. It's just a piece of paper, kids.
That's what I've tried in the past, and people just like look
scares
at you.
The hell out of them. They don't want to hear
that. It's challenging, and you know, it's the only reason we're even doing this is people have asked. It's like, can you talk about these topics? You know, there's
and
some
by the
demand.
Way, out you got to do it in 1,500 words. So get to work.
Yeah, I'm like double that. So
oh, good. It's
fun. I enjoy it. I think the topic is just inherently interesting. Again, like we were saying earlier, some of the products may be a little hypey or whatever, but we wouldn't be doing it if folks didn't ask us to look at this stuff.
Yeah. So. And as you were saying, Dan, and I can't wait to hear the interview tomorrow with Tim O'Reilly, but there is some very interesting technology here that probably is going to be around for a long time, like blockchain, in interesting uses. So it's important for people to understand that too, I think. Dan Patterson, so great to have you, technology reporter, CBS News, cbsnews.com/live. Don't forget.
Net.biz.
Now, do you have a regular time slot or anything? I mean,
no, I do segments throughout the week, and I write stories. So tomorrow I'm on in the 7:40 a.m. Eastern hour. But it could be the afternoon, evening. It's sometimes it's when news breaks. Other times it's when I have a story.
Really glad that CBS is taking streaming seriously because I've always thought CBS News was like the quality. Ever since Edward R. Murrow, it's the Tiffany Network, and I hope that standard still applies. I think it does, and we need it. So I'm glad that they're taking streaming seriously. This is obviously the future of broadcasting. Yes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We take streaming seriously.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat room wants to know, just a question. You don't have to answer it. Are you really tall or do you have a very low ceiling?
No, I have a lofted apartment.
Okay. Because it looks like you're scraping the ceiling there. He has big hair too, right?
That is true. No, I'm just
it's New York. What do you want? They don't have room. They don't have room for high ceilings. It's very good. Still a little island. There's not a lot of room. Thank you, Dan Spritton. Great to have you. And of course, always
great
a pleasure. Owen Thomas, I hope to see you at the theater someday soon. I think it's the last time I saw you in person was at the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco.
That's right. Was it Hamilton night or?
I don't remember, but you were with, I think you were with Ian Thompson and you were just coming out and we were just going in and it was great to see you and I haven't been to the theater since.
Remember theater, remember theater. Shows.
Theater. You know, Lisa and I were all set to go back to New York and then they closed Broadway again. So we're just going to have to wait. Just have to wait. It's great to have you on. Thank you for being here. Protocol is
a very
good publication. Protocol.com. Thanks to all of you for joining us, by the way. We do Twit Sunday afternoons. We take all the week's news. We mush it up into a great big ball and then throw it at you. All you have to do to watch live is go to twit.tv/live. Or you can go to live.twit.tv. And we do that live stream about 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 22:30 UTC. People will watch live, like to chat live. That's at irc.twit.tv. You can do it with a browser or an IRC client. Doesn't matter. irc.twit.tv or in the Discord channel if you're a member of Club Twit. After the fact, every show we do is available on our website. For most of the shows, audio and video, although, as I said, we're going to try some new audio shows, which is cool. Twit.tv is the website. Twit.tv/clubtwit to sign up for Club Twit. Twit.tv/store to buy mugs or face diapers with the Twit logo on it, whatever it is you wear in the movie. Yeah, we have really good looking masks. you could have the Security Now mask, which I think would be a good conversation starter to have Steve Gibson on your face. That's at twit.tv/store. You have two ways to interact with us after the fact. You can go to our twit.community, which is our discourse forums, regular kind of forums, online forums. We also have a Mastodon instance at twit.social, kind of like Twitter for the Fediverse. There's a YouTube channel for this show and all the shows, so you can watch the video. Best thing to do would be subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you get it automatically. And if your podcast player allows for reviews, please leave us a 5-star review. Let the world know you listen to the world's longest continuous running technology podcast. 17 years. We're going to celebrate an anniversary in April, right, John? For the 2015, 2005. 17 plus 2, carry the 4. I think it's 17 years. I'm pretty sure. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Easy.